And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Working folks in Allentown area, they want a hard-fought victory, another reason that the National Labor Relations Board must be the dreaded NLRB. Exactly why it must be destroyed, torn to shreds, ripped and gutted and defunded and, well, any nominee blocked and filibustered and, you know, the whole right-wing cocktail. But we'll talk about that victory. Also, political hacks who view crisis as an opportunity, you know, that opportunity to destroy what generations of folks have built. And also, not to mention the opportunity for people to, you know, the profiteers to prosper at our expense, of course. We're going to talk about that. Austerity, sequester, slash and burn, whatever you want to call it. Well, the results are the same. Pain for you and me and profit at the top. We're going to look at some of that, some of the fallout from the austerity bomb and the competing budget plans. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, comments. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Hope everyone had a green weekend. It was St. Paddy's Day weekend, and here in Harrisburg had a marvelous parade. What I find really amazing, and we were walking through the streets of Harrisburg today, ran into someone who works at one of the local establishments who said, you know, on Drunken Day, which is what St. Paddy's Day has turned into, you know, a couple of yahoos were chest bumping, and one got a little exuberant, chest bumped his buddy right through a plate glass window and into a restaurant where children were sitting. And then they tried to run off. But that's a whole other story. But, you know, hey, what we need more of, folks, we need more days like that. We need more drunken disorderly. And we need booze everywhere. So I find it rather fitting that in the day after the weekend of drunken stupor in the streets, because when I was a kid, growing up through high school, St. Patrick's Day, the big parade, was the day that you ripped school, you went downtown, you drank a whole bunch of green beer, and then you had what the Australians call a technicolored yawn. And you can think about that any way you want. It's basically, you open your mouth really wide and lots of pretty colors come out, especially green on St. Patrick's Day, because that is what you consumed. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say the actual process of things coming up and out, but you get the drift. So I find it rather interesting that on the day after the big Technicolor yawn holiday, we have a Republican Party who wants to make that more accessible to everyone. And this afternoon, the House Liquor Committee voted on HB 790, which is the privatization bill of the wine and spirit shops. That would kill some 5,000 jobs, and I find it really just amazing that that's kind of been lost. The right-wing rabid response, well, you know, government doesn't belong in the business, so we need to sell it off. But I find it interesting that on this day, the day after the big holiday, the House Liquor Control Committee voted 14 to 10 along party lines to push it out of the committee onto the full House. Probably could happen sometime, you know, maybe later than this week, early next week. Tomorrow will really tell. It's going to really be real interesting to see, because, you know, right now as we speak, Mike Terzai, the guy in the House, the head of the House, and Corbett are doing a lot of arm twisting. Because they've got a bunch of Republicans who are going, wait a second, for a couple of good reasons. One, do you really want to have that kind of alcohol saturation? Do you want a liquor store on every corner? Do you want to become like Washington, D.C.? Do you want to become like a lot of states who've just given up control? Oh, you want to have a free market, yes, booze and whatever on every corner. So you have those folks who are saying, well, not so thrilled. You have the kind of the conservative hypocrites. And I look at the Mike Fulmers of the world in that vein, because, you know, they keep talking about their conservative ideology, which would be, we don't want to have liquor everywhere. We have some social problems that come out of having mass consumption of alcohol, like I remember as a kid, because it was everywhere. It was rampant because it was so easily accessible. So you would think that there would be those conservatives who, like me as a hypocritical parent now, who did all these things as a kid, don't want my kids doing it. Kind of, you know, that's things how they go. So you would think that they would be saying, no, no, we can't have so much availability. No, their position on it, the Fulmers of the world, well, we need to protect the beer people. Because the beer people, they have license, and the beer people, understand, on one hand, we shouldn't be in the business, and on the other hand, we need to fix and keep those people who are in the business, need to keep them okay while stealing a state asset. And, you know, it just blows my mind. And then you've got the people who are going, look, you know, the system works fine. It brings revenue into the state. The fiscal conservatives, who I tend to agree with, it brings a lot of money into the state. We don't have to pay the 1% tax that we're getting now that we would have to give up in the future. We wouldn't lose that. We wouldn't lose the long-term profitability of the money coming rolling in. We could do some modernization. We could, if you really wanted to have more availability, we could do like they do in Ohio, where you have little state stores and every supermarket who's happy to pay the cost to have you there because it's a draw for people to come in. You could do that. You could do a lot of things. But saying, here, we're just going to give it away and let the reins go seems ludicrous to me. And the other part that nobody is talking about is the costs associated with enforcement. Because now we're going to have to hire people to go to every one of these establishments, and they're saying about 1,200 to start. So as the 600 that we currently have go away, that will double to 1,200. Now you're talking, instead of having people in every store that you know are not selling to teenagers and you know are not going to screw up a perfectly good paying job, now you're going to have to worry about 1,200, twice as many of these stores, and it being on the shelves of places where people make minimum wage. Can anyone see the disaster in this? Can anyone see where there might be problems, where there might be the availability of my kids in the next couple of years getting this stuff? And yeah, I know I'm looking at it from a fairly self-centered position. One, my family. Two, my tax dollars. Three, my safety driving home. Yeah, I mean, purely personal. And I think every person in this Commonwealth should think of that way. Do we want our kids to have that kind of access? No. Do we want to lose that kind of revenue so that we're going to have to make up that additional revenue somewhere, either through higher taxes or cuts to programs, cuts to education, cuts to senior programs, cuts to infrastructure? And then, you know, the other part of it is, you know, do we really want the societal costs? Do we want more accidents? Do we want more incarceration? Do we want more of the ills that comes with it? Now, part of me hopes that, you know, and part of me is hopeful that they don't have the votes again like they didn't last year. But you don't know. You don't know how well the governor and Terzai are. You don't know how well they're twisting arms. And it's going to come down to who twists the arms the best and what they do to sweeten the pot. Now, I look at a statement by a guy named Miskin, Steve Miskin. He's the he's Mike Terzai's right-hand man, who said this wine privatization, wine and spirits privatization issue, is one of the most vetted issues in the history of the General Assembly. One of the most vetted issues. And, you know, I think about it, okay, it's one of the most vetted issues. If that's the case, then why do they keep changing it so often? Why is it, you know, if you remember, we were going to get $2 billion. It's going to be a huge cash cow. And then when you peeled back the layer of onion, it was, well, no, maybe one and a half. No, maybe one, maybe 500 million. And then, oh, no, well, it's not about the money. Not about the money at all. It's about core function of government. And then you realize that was a load of BS. And now you've got Corbett saying, no, we need to tie that to education. Yes, we need to tie it to education. You know, booze for books or shots for tots. But now you see this bill, it doesn't actually put the money into education. It's not earmarked specifically towards the educational block grants that Corbett said it was. Trouble. And you go through this and you realize this is a massive screw job to the taxpayers of this Commonwealth. But I go back to Miskin's statement, one of the most vetted issues in history. And they've done this in the last 2 years. And I guess my first thought when I read that was something very simple. The last 2 years, can you think of anything else we should have been doing? We have been talking about this ad nauseum for 2 years. This issue has divided our General Assembly for 2 years. We have put so much time, so much energy, so much resource into this issue, which is going to destroy jobs. There are going to be 5,000 people who are going to lose their jobs in this Commonwealth. 5,000, negative, gone, done, zip, out the door. Alcohol will now be another item on the shelf. Can you think of anything that we should have been talking about in those 2 years? I can think of a bunch of things. Number one, and I'll take a quote right from the Republican Party and their little coloring flashy book that they came out with as the T-Twits took power. Laser-like focus. You'll remember, and you can sing it with me if you want. Jobs, jobs, jobs. They're telling us they believe in it, but yet everything that they've done, the most vetted issue in the history of the Commonwealth, is actually going to destroy jobs. Now, I guess you could make the argument, and a very cogent argument at that, that the disaster that this would be would create more jobs. Because as we have a greater consumption and greater availability for young people to get alcohol, maybe there'll be more crashes, so more mechanics are going to be able to put cars back together. There's one job creator part. More people in jail, sure, why not? The injuries and the homicides and all that stuff that go with alcohol consumption, yeah, right to the hospital. So a boom for the medical industry. So maybe this is a job creator after all. This is the disaster capitalism that the right loves to throw at us. We can't do anything right, so let's do it wrong so it screws things up and we can make a ton of money on the back end. That's all I can come up with, because nothing rational pops into my head when talking about this. Is what people want more convenience? Do you want to go to the supermarket and buy your bottle of Jack? No, I haven't met anyone who'd say, yeah, I'd love to have that. I want to do that. Maybe a six-pack, I can see that. But you know what? We're protecting them. That's what the beauty of this is. It's not even about what people really want. Because if you look at the polls, people want to be able to buy a six-pack in the supermarket. That's it. Most people don't want to have hard liquor on the shelf next to the Tic Tacs. Most rational, sane, thoughtful people, they don't want that. They know where to get that stuff if they need it. Just like me, I know where to go when I need it. When I'm having a party, and I can think ahead. I go back to when I was a kid. Look, when I was a kid, you could go through the drive-thru. You have a big drive-thru, and you could buy a single solitary can of beer. And it would be cold. But we don't promote drinking and driving. So we're going to give you a single can, we're going to hand it to you in the window, and it's going to be cold and you can drive it off. Now what you do once you leave, that's your business, because we don't know. But you could drive through by 40 ounces, you could drive through by a single bottle. Is that what we want? Because look, when you start talking about free market, hey, we want convenience. Because when I was a kid, drinking and driving was like a sport. I think we've seen a movement away from that, and I don't want to go back. And I think this is just plain dumb on so many levels, both from societal, the parental, and the taxpayer. Screwed, screwed, screwed. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Beyond the Checklist, What Else Healthcare Can Learn from Aviation Teamwork and Safety is a new book that explores the parallels between aviation and healthcare and how over the decades, aviation has evolved while healthcare has not. The book details how when the aviation industry was plagued with a high rate of crashes, the industry came together and developed crew resource management. The goal of CRM was to change the paradigm where the pilot was king of the plane and didn't listen to anyone else. The book argues that the United States healthcare industry, where nearly 100,000 people die due to safety issues and lack of communication, can save lives by adopting CRM. Suzanne Gordon, a co-author of the book, explains.
They teach people how to communicate. They teach people how to listen to other people. They teach people not only to listen to other people, but to solicit input from other people, which is very different from listening to other people, right? They teach people how to challenge authority.
Gordon said CRM breaks the perception that an airplane is something a pilot owns. If a first officer detects that a captain isn't acting with all of his faculties, he can take control of the situation. She said that doesn't currently exist in most surgery rooms.
If an intensive care doctor sees a surgeon making a big mistake, he can't take that patient away from the surgeon. The surgeon conceptualizes the patient as something he or she owns. It's very difficult to take control of the ship, as it were, from somebody who's taking that ship, i.e. the patient, into the ground, and it happens every day.
Gordon said the fears doctors express of CRM echo the same pilots had in the 80s. It took a concerted effort by the companies to reassure the pilots that CRM was the right thing to do.
They worked with organizational psychologists, sociolinguists, human factors researchers. They worked with the government. They worked with the union.
She said it isn't only the doctors not communicating. It's a toxic hierarchy.
In my view, in healthcare, toxic hierarchy is a gift that keeps on giving. And this total refusal to share information and to even conceptualize the need to share information.
Gordon said it may take federal regulation to change the way the healthcare industry communicates.
Federal regulations require a whole bunch of things in aviation that are not required in healthcare. So that in aviation, pretty quickly, they started training the captains of the ship, you know, the pilots, and then they started with the pilots, and then they moved to the flight attendants and the ground crew and air traffic control and everything.
Keep them listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to the NLRB and other agencies.
Really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy, but if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world.
Yes, what a wonderful world it would be indeed if, well, you didn't have those pesky rules, if you didn't have to deal with minimum wage or maximum hour laws. And I go back, you know, to Rand Paul's little rant last week, you know, talking about we need to rethink that wonderful decision known as Lochner. We need to go back to the good old days when government and we the people could do nothing to protect workers in this country. That would be such a wonderful thing. It was such a wonderful time when the robber barons controlled everything. And we could fire people at will, you know, whatever, for whatever we wanted or for no reason whatsoever. And you know what? For most people, they can. Except for that one little thing where you say, you know what? I want to try and make my life a little bit better. I'd like to join and form collectively into a labor union or association. There's some protection for that. And employers not so happy about that. So when they fire people and it turns around and they did it in the wrong way, well, that thing that the right seems to hate so much, the NLRB, comes to play, which is why I've asked Teamsters Local 773 President Dennis Howard to come talk to us, because in the Allentown area, There were 13 workers terminated. Why? Because they had the audacity to discuss the potential, the possibility of joining a labor union. Dennis, thanks for taking time for me.
No problem, Rick.
So explain this to me, because, you know, we see this case time and time again where people, you know, wear a union button or say, hey, I might want to consider this, and then they end up finding themselves on the street. Walk me through what happened here at this Pratt Corporation, Corrugated Logistics, there in Lower Macungie.
Well, basically what happened was that they started out just like any other organizing drive. A couple of drivers came to us looking for representation. We started having meetings with them, and after the very first meeting, one of the drivers went back to the company and said, hey, there's some guys looking to form a union here, and I think that's when they started their interrogation of the workers. Typically what you see is they'll fire one. This is probably the first time we've seen them fire just basically almost the entire workforce.
Well, they don't want to take any chances, right? And I
right.
think you used the right word there, interrogation. Because, you know, too often what we see going on in this country is anytime anyone say, hey, you know, maybe I want to might think about, you know, my rights, that type of harassment and intimidation comes into play.
Well, yeah, that's true. There really is no penalty for an employer to do this. Usually what happens is they'll fire one, everyone else gets scared, and that ends your union drive. And the hardest part is getting people to stand up for their own rights. We were very proud of the workers here at Pratt that stood up for what they believed in. They knew they were wronged, and they were going to do something about it, and we were more than happy to help them out.
So these 13 drivers that got fired, and according to the NLRB judge, ordered them back to work with back pay and benefits. Explain how that happened.
Well, we filed charges with the labor board, and the initial process is that they have smaller hearings to determine if there's merit to the charge. And what typically happens if they do find merit is we try to work out some sort of settlement. Usually they bring them back. Sometimes they'll offer a settlement if the driver or employee doesn't want to go back. But this case, the company was headstrong. They didn't want to settle. And so it went all the way to the administrative law judge.
And what were the penalties? Because I talk about this quite often on the program, that the penalties are pathetic. Basically just the wages that they would have lost, minus whatever it is that they were able to earn during that time frame, which if you had a job that paid the exact same thing, there would be no penalty, or am I missing something?
That's exactly true. Typically, they'll get unemployment if they're lucky enough to get the unemployment. We were able to place some of the drivers with other Teamster represented companies in the area. A couple of them took those jobs and stayed. So we're happy to have them as Teamsters today.
Yeah. Now, what about the rest of them? And as these folks have got their jobs back, are they back to work today?
Yes. They went back a couple weeks ago under a separate agreement with the company. They brought them back, but they did not want to pay back pay at that point. So we continued on with the case, and here we are today with a really great ruling.
Which, again, I look at this and I go, someone actually stood up for the little guy. This is why I see so much push from the right. If it's not ALEC-supported legislation, it's Tea Party people saying we need to destroy the NLRB, because how dare there be a group out there that actually looks after workers?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I joined this union over 22 years ago, I started working at UPS, which was already organized. All I had to do was sign an application for membership. I really respect the people that are willing to stick their necks out on the line here and do what's right. And at least with our local and with the Teamsters, we're going to stand by them all the way to the end. And I think it's important for them to know that they have nothing to fear, that we are behind them.
You know, it's interesting that you point that you say your path, and mine was much the same way. You know, I went in through a company that was already existing, that my grandparents' generation fought to organize and to turn those jobs into the middle class jobs that they were. And much the same as you've said, I look at folks who are willing to take to the streets and stand up and say, there's only so much of what I'm willing to eat, and we're going to fight back. I have the utmost respect for them.
Yeah, and we're seeing it more. I mean, people are just getting so fed up with everything. The income inequality in this country, it's just unbelievable. And things are getting worse, not better. and you know, you saw the decline in union membership, and I think that has, you know, it's a direct correlation to the decline in wages for the middle class. And you know, sooner or later, people are going to start standing up, and these guys did such a great job. I mean, they stuck to their guns and won.
Yeah, so
it can be done.
Well, it can absolutely be done, and we cover story after story across the country of where working people are doing just that. I mean, you look here in our backyard, we got kids from all across the world who have been exploited and abused by an unscrupulous employer, and they took to the streets and said no more. And you know, again, here you're talking about kids who came here for an American experience, and I think they got one. This, we're going to stand up, and we're not going to take it. We're going to fight back, and we're going to hold people accountable. And I hope that the message is getting out. And you know, when unionization really exploded after World War II, it was after a generation of people who said, you know, there's only so much of you know what we're going to eat, and we're not taking it anymore. And I think right now we're at that same junction in history.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. We've got to get our story back out there again. You know, I talked to some young people. You try to explain what a union does and what we do, or you know, I've run into people with kids, and they say, you know, the Teamsters, and they look like, what's that? It's shocking to me, you know, because I've lived it. We need to do a better job of educating these people and showing them what we can do.
Yeah, I mean,
because it does work. It's clear it works.
Yeah, this generation needs to. I don't know how old you are, but we're probably about the same age.
Yeah.
But this generation needs to have the same view of labor that I had growing up, which, you know, as a kid growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, I saw union membership as that path to the middle class, that ability for my work, my labor, the sweat of my brow and the ache of my back to support a family and have some future and some retirement at the end.
Yeah. I mean, my father was a union member, and he was able to support our family. Now we didn't live rich at all, but he was able to support our family. My mom stayed home and raised my brother and I. Really proud of that upbringing.
Yeah, I mean, the concept of a fair day's pay for a fair day's work, simple
yep.
concept, one we need to regain again. But last question I've got on this before I talk to the organizer on the case. You know, where are you right now with contractually? I mean, does this come with, hey, you have to come and sit down and bargain with these, or was it just we're going to put them back to work?
No, the order was to put them back to work with back pay and benefits, and one of the other parts of the ruling was that they have to open up the ballots. When we already did have an election, they opened up 5 ballots. Those were for some of the ones I think they didn't want union representation, or they were at least scared when they had it. I guess I can say that. But they had challenged 12 of the 13 ballots. So the 13 people that they fired, 12 were allowed to vote. So we're waiting now for the labor board. Part of this decision is that the labor board now can open up those challenge ballots, and then we'll see where we stand with the election.
No, that was, you know, because I look at this and I go, you know, at the end of the day, you got the guys their job back, but what happens in a week or 2 weeks or down the road, they've still got bullseyes on their back.
Well, yeah, well, but again, just like we did from day one, we're, you know, we've got their back, and we'll do what we have to do.
All right, Dennis Hauer, I appreciate the time. President of Teamsters Local 773. Thanks so much. Let's talk with Dennis Fry. He's a business agent there at Local 773 and also the organizer on this. Dennis, Darren, thanks for taking time for me.
No problem, Rick. How are you doing?
I am good. You know, I look at this, and it's like any organizing. It's the hard work of getting down and talking to people and allaying some of the fears of folks, because no one wants to be one of these 13 people fired.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's what the employers depend on,
but
scare tactics.
Exactly. But in this case, you know, it worked out that they got their jobs back, and with the support of Local 773 there and the Teamsters overall, I look at this, and the message out of this has to be, look, you know, there's someone by your side. There's someone behind you to help grow that and build that middle class again.
That's true. That's exactly right, Rick.
So in looking at this, where do you see this? And I know we just talked to Dennis there a second ago, where the ballots are going to be counted. What's going to happen into the future with the contract and going forward?
Well, what I expect is that when we open the ballots, the 12 challenge ballots are going to be, majority of them are going to be positive votes. You know, they were voting right after they were illegally terminated for their protected activities. So I think we're going to win the election. And then we're going to ask for negotiations.
And your experience, how often does this happen that, you know, someone gets fired, or 13 is highly unusual. I got to be honest. I don't think I've heard that I know I haven't heard it recently, but I haven't heard that kind of a number of people fired over an organizing drive in a long time.
This has never happened in my experience.
And to me, you know, I got to be honest, you know, in organizing drives that I've been a part of in the past, you know, when one person gets fired, I always wondered why the reaction was to be afraid and to pull back instead of being angry and saying, this is why we need to organize. This is why we need to have that protection. That's always been my thought. I'm curious where you're at.
Well, that's true. I don't understand that. And that's why I commend this group of drivers for sticking together, because that's exactly what I think bound them together, was that, you know, first they fired one coworker, then they fired another one 2 days later, and then, you know, a week later they laid off 11 more. So, you know, after the first two were terminated, like you said, they were upset. And they were willing to stick together, you know, for the two. The icing on the cake for them was when they went and, you know, fired 11 more.
Yeah, I mean, you got to wonder who's given this company that kind of advice. I know that they're owned by an Australian family, but, you know, even in Australia, they've got strong. Well, Australia has much stronger labor laws than we do.
Well, you know, it's only my speculation, but it's a pretty good speculation that it was a union buster that they hired. They hired him, and after the first two discharges, and had this union buster. This is a man who was a former National Labor Relations Board agent turned a consultant, quote unquote, and he came and interrogated him or interviewed him that first week after our meeting, and by the end of the week, the 11 more were gone. And this union consultant, or I should say anti-union consultant, advertised himself as a union buster on his website.
Yeah, I mean, there's something seriously wrong with that. You know, I go back to my grandfather and his generation. You know, my grandfather always said, you know, sometimes you need to smack somebody to make a citizen out of them. And I look at people like that, and, you know, I understand what he was talking about.
Right, right.
But anyway, as this goes forward, where do you see this going from here? Because, you know, like you said, this is not the usual way things operate. Maybe one, maybe two, but not 13. Where do you see this going?
Well, unfortunately, you know, just based on my last year of experience with this company, I'm afraid they're going to appeal it. You know, they're going to tie it up. You know, they have that right. They have that right to appeal the decision. I don't think it'll go anywhere. I mean, I think that the facts are what the facts are, and they're not going to change. The judge, the administrative law judge who ruled on the case, did a very good job. He was very analytical, explained his thought process completely, and I don't see, you know, anybody overturning his decision. It's just so clear.
Right. But, you know, I look at this, and I see a lot of these cases where the will of, because we heard a lot of people saying, well, you know, people should be able to have the freedom to do this. And I say, yeah, you're right. When the majority of people say they want to have this, they should be able to have it. It shouldn't be something that we have laws so antiquated, broken, and fractured that it takes years, if not a generation. I look at, you know, the Smithfield case, was 20 years before those people got a contract. We should have the way things used to be.
I agree. It's come to a terrible time right now.
So the question is, how do we get back to that? And to me, it comes down to, you know, folks like you going out and doing the hard work of organizing, educating folks. These people right here saying, you know what, I was mistreated, and we're going to make sure that doesn't happen to somebody else down the road.
Right, right. You know, I agree with Dennis too. You know, we got to educate our people, and we really got to focus on young people.
Yep.
Because kids today are coming out of high school, going to college, and they know nothing about a union.
And that, I believe, is all by design. I think all labor education has been stripped from the curriculum. I think anything having to do with labor education in higher ed has been destroyed. You look at all the labor education centers that used to be in colleges around this country that have been gutted and thrown away for cause, so that history is gone and the right can rewrite it any way they want.
Yeah.
Which is what we've been saying.
It looks like it's what it's come to.
Yeah. But I congratulations to you, to Local 773, to those workers who got their jobs back, and I wish you the best in going forward with the case and with negotiations.
Well, thank you, Rick. Thank you so much.
Darren, thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7234. 7425. This is the Rick Smith Show for working people from the talk.
We got to do it today. No more madness and cruelty. No more disarray. We got to get it tonight.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
In a recent senatorial dust-up, Senator John McCain dubbed his Republican colleague Rand Paul one of the, quote, wacko birds in Congress. McCain, who sometimes appears not too tightly wrapped himself, was giving Senator Paul a tongue-lashing for having mounted a 13-hour old-fashioned standalone filibuster over the possibility that murderous drones could be used for targeted assassinations of Americans right here at home. McCain said that the Kentucky senator's talkathon had veered into, quote, the realm of the ridiculous, adding that, I don't think it is helpful to the American people. I hate to interrupt when one Republican Solon is hammering another, but I'm siding with Rand Paul. While plenty of the Tea Party senators' extreme right-wing stands are wacko, this isn't one of them. Unfortunately for America, powerful corporate interests are eager to reap billions in profit from the spread of drones across our land, and police agencies at all levels are drooling at the prospect of adding weaponized fleets of drones to their arsenals. Indeed, what's ridiculous is that other Congress critters have not been paying attention, speaking out, and taking action. Call it grandstanding if you want, but at least Paul took an actual stand. And, contrary to McCain's opinion, it was quite helpful to the American people. Thanks to Paul's attention-getting combination of principle, ego, and chutzpah, the great majority of Americans heard for the first time that these inherently invasive, liberty-busting, and potentially deadly drones are on the verge of being deployed domestically. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's why the Congressional Progressive Caucus and such alert Democrats as Senator Ron Wyden have joined in sounding the alarm and demanding a full public debate on the cost to our democracy before we let profiteers unleash this technology on us. As Senator Paul says, at least we need to know what are the rules.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point. I mean, the Republicans would be going nuts.
We want to talk about disconnected. I don't even know the disconnected. There's part of me that goes, well, there's disconnected, and then there's just plain freaking stupid. Or I guess you could look at it, you know, stupid on one hand, or just completely disingenuous. Our tweet of the day comes from my representative, Stephen Bloom, who I've never accused of being the brightest bulb in the box, but a good ideologue and a good follower, and kind of what the GOP likes. You know, someone who's going to follow the marching order of the moneyed interest, and he does that quite well. But on the issue of the wine and spirit shops, he tweeted out, this week in the PA House, state-owned, union-run, taxpayer-funded, inconvenient liquor monopoly versus you, the taxpayer. And you go, wait a second, hold on. I get the state-owned, because it's owned by by us, collectively, all of us. We all own a share in this thing known as the wine and spirit shops, the liquor control board, all of this ours. So all of the things that we get from it, like $500 million a year, the tax that we would otherwise not, that we actually do pay that we're going to give up, that comes to us as well. And this idea that it's against us. What it is it's a ripoff of us. It's a ripoff of you and me. And this idea that it's union run, really? No. It's run by us. Because those workers have a voice, and those workers have a reasonable wage, and those workers have, you know, maybe some health care and a little bit of pension. Could that be the reason the Stephen Blooms of the world hate them? Kind of makes you wonder, though, doesn't it? What is it? What is it about this issue? Because, you know, you stop and you think about the true conservative mentality, which is not to destroy institution. You know, when I learned about conservatives, you know, years ago, you know, conservatives were people who believed in tradition, they believed in institutions, they believed in strengthening what you have, strengthening your foundation instead of destroying it. Radical change, not something they were looking for. What we have now running the Republican Party are radicals like Bloom. People who want to destroy the foundation of the things that this state was built on. And the revenue. You know, last weekend I was reading, we had talked to one of the Teamsters down from York last week about how the police department was being outsourced, or they were trying to outsource it because of the funding levels. And he had mentioned that Middletown was going to be going through the same thing. And someone sent me an article on what's going on in Middletown. And evidently, Middletown used to sell electricity to their residents back when we were a regulated state where here was the bottom line. And they tacked a little bit on to the cost of electricity so that everybody who used it funded the area government so that you could provide, you know, fire protection and police protection and roads and all of those things. Well, since deregulation, what happened was is you got a handful of people saying, well, we don't want to pay more, we're going to sue, and basically dried up the revenue stream that funded the government. So now you're talking about a crisis that was created through more deregulation and privatization. This whole, I don't want to pay for anything, but I want everything for free. Very, very right now Republican mentality. And you look at this and you go, how far are these people willing to take this nation? How far down the rabbit hole are we willing to go? And I look at this tweet by Bloom who I hope he knows better. I do. I hope he understands that what he is advocating for is a destruction of that and also higher costs for you and me. Higher taxes, higher liquor prices. If you're one of those people who partakes in the wine and spirit, understand it's going to be higher prices. And my wife and I were just talking about this, you know, at lunch this morning. And, you know, I said, you know, they're probably going to go, this might go through. I mean, if any chance in our history, if there was ever a chance, now is the time. Because they've got people so riled up and so angry at themselves. You know, ticked off at government. Understand, the people we put into these offices over here, we put them there. People like Stephen Bloom, we put him there. So all of the people who live in my neighborhood who voted for him, when your taxes go up and the cost of wine and spirits goes up because we've now privatized and profitized this and the profit is leaving the state because the people like Walmarts and the big grocery stores, and they're the ones who are selling it, not Pennsylvania-based so much. Think about that. That happens, and they funnel everything through the Delaware loophole to where it's not even taxed that way, and you start going, well, gee, the state coffers are dwindling, and local property taxes are going up, or local everything is going up. Remember this, because this is the most vetted issue in the history of our General Assembly. This was something that the Republicans thought and thought and thought about and rethought about and rethought about and re-engineered and tweaked and all of these things so that they could get Well, maximum profit. And they're all on the same page. You hear them all saying the same thing. Oh, it's going to be so exciting to get Pennsylvania out of the business of liquor. Because understand, once you go down this, once you open that door, there is no going back. Sorry, no readmission, no reentry. It's over, it's done, it's gone. All you have from this point forward are all of the negative, the horrible, and the terrible outcomes. All of the externalities that we now control for are going to be, well, part of the free market of which you and I will pay for. So he's right. It is against you and me. It is against we, the taxpayer. And he is on the wrong side of it. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Ocean of Red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
On March 13, 2013, the ALMA telescope in the Atacama Desert in northern Chile officially came online. ALMA stands for Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. This telescope will be able to see the universe in a resolution 10 times greater than that of the Hubble Space Telescope. Allison Peck, ALMA Deputy Project Scientist, explained that the altitude, 16,500 feet, or 5,000 meters, and the dry desert climate of ALMA's location helped make it so powerful.
The main enemy of millimeter or submillimeter astronomy is not light, like it is for optical telescopes, but rather water. Having a location like this, high in the mountains, up in the desert, means that your sensitivity is much, much greater than it would be anywhere else in the world.
Though not the first telescope of its kind, it's the fastest and most powerful. ALMA will penetrate clouds of dust and gas to help astronomers study the birth of planets, stars, and galaxies in the near and distant universe.
Things that have never been detectable before, things that appear dark to optical telescopes, will be detectable with ALMA.
The ALMA array, consisting of six large radio dishes connected together, will allow astronomers to look 12 billion years back in time. For more on the ALMA telescope, come to EarthSky.org and search ALMA. That's A-L-M-A. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell we fighting for? Just surrender and water at all. Just got time to say your prayer while you're waiting for the hammer.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So I look where I live in Cumberland County, where one of the county commissioners is Gary Eichelberger, who said that, you know, we need a mission review. We need to, you know, evaluate what we do and what the county should be doing and where we can make cuts. And understand, that's the goal. The goal is slash and burn. The goal has always been with these radical Republicans to destroy what my grandparents' generation and what our parents have built. Sell it off, hock it off, whatever, destroy it. And, you know, the mind frame that he came out with last week, this idea that we need to have this mission review as a crisis management tool, because, hey, we're in crisis, and his frame of we're a sinking ship, and we need to figure out what we can throw overboard to keep from sinking, is the mentality that they have. And what blows my mind is that we're not absolutely infuriated by this mentality. In fact, it's one of these things that I hear people saying, well, what we need, well, we need to have the balanced budget, and we need to do that by cutting things. Indiscriminately just slash and burn, which falls right into the analogy of the sinking ship. And I look where I live in Carlisle, where they are tearing down the remnants of really what was an industrial base in the area, because we have this beggar thy neighbor economic development. And we have this idea that, well, the free market has decided. There's no managing what happens in your environment. There's no managing the economy. It's just whatever happens. Now, what the county is going to do is they're going to hire a consultant to see what it is we should get rid of. And they're going to hire this consultant group for about $80 an hour. And I wonder how many hours they're going to put into it. So I go through this and I think, okay, so we have some financial problems. We're some short here or there. We got to think about how we're going to get this. So the best thing that we can do is go spend more money having people tell us what we already know, which is we're not bringing in enough revenue. Seems pretty logical to me, we're not bringing enough revenue. The idea that we need to go slash and burn, which will inevitably harm those at the bottom, which I guess is okay to someone like this because, those people at the bottom, they don't vote anyway. Because, they've done a masterful job of dividing us up. But it's amazing to me how much we're willing to sell off. And I understand, the Cumberland County Commissioners, this idea that, well, we need to have this review. What they're looking at doing is selling things off. Evidently, the county owns some land, so we'll sell that off. This county's got some assets, sell those off. So we can get that one-time infusion of money to fill the short-term problem that we have, and over the long haul, someone else is going to gain the profits. I look at the wine and spirit shops in the same light. Hey, we've got this great asset that's bringing in $500 million a year, and we're getting a whole bunch of other benefits from it. No, we need to get rid of that because we can get a one-time infusion of $1 billion, which is 2 years of profits. And after the second year, we get nothing out of it. So congratulations. You've sold off a perfectly viable asset for pennies on the dollar. Congratulations. That's something that a business person would absolutely not do. And I love how the right keeps telling me, well, we need to run government like a business. Then don't sell off your assets, ding-dongs. And I look at this Harrisburg incinerator. One, I wouldn't have done it the way they did it, but here we are in this situation. I guess they're a couple of days away from signing off on the sale of the incinerator. And the part that I love about it, look, it's a huge debt. It's an albatross around Harrisburg's neck. Something has to be done with it. But what blows my mind is they're going to have this Lancaster County Solid Waste Management Authority take it over. And guess what? They don't have the money to buy it, so it's not going to be finalized for a couple of months, and we'll see what happens. But here's the beautiful part of this. The whole deal hinges on the rates and what the state is going to buy in terms of steam-generated electricity. So understand when I tell you this. Harrisburg is going to sell off this asset, and it is an asset. It's an overpriced asset. They're losing money on it because they owe so much in debt on it, but they're going to give it off to somebody else. They're going to guarantee them high enough rates to make sure that they get their $340 million back from it, plus the state's going to guarantee that they buy steam electricity so that there's a big enough profit. So I got the only one simple question. Why the hell are you selling it? If you can guarantee that the rates are going to be such and such and the amount of electricity generated through steam is going to be purchased, why the hell would you sell it? Why can't you get that for yourself? Oh, that's right, because you're going to be on the hook for it. This is just dumb to me. Another one of these stupid, how'd you get in the problem in the first place? By doing dumb things like this. And the better yet? Because I can't wait to see the details because the devil is always in the details. What happens if Harrisburg wants to put a solar bank in is, or the state of Pennsylvania wants to do something with solar banks or wind or something else that's going to detract from the amount of steam energy they buy. Is there going to be a contract violation there? And are we the taxpayers going to pick that up too? It's kind of funny. And then you hear reading the report that, you know, Harrisburg's looking at leasing off their parking garages, which, you know, we've talked about what happened in Pittsburgh. Can't put public transportation in because, well, it's going to harm our parking profits. So if you do decide that you're going to change the amount of public transportation coming in, oh, you're going to have to pay us a guaranteed amount. So if Harrisburg decided that, you know, Carlisle to Harrisburg, they ever did decide to get their heads out of their keisters and put Corridor 1 into place, sorry, can't do it because, well, without a huge penalty, because, well, the parking profiteers, they need to make sure that they're well healed. I mean, isn't it amazing? Think about this just for one second. Isn't it amazing how the people who tell us they believe in the free market, the people who should get government out and there shouldn't be any, are the first ones to say we need to have a floor. We need to make sure that the rates are set, and we need to make sure that the state's going to buy steam-generated electricity. We need to have these guarantees. Isn't it amazing? And who ends up getting caught holding the bag? Well, we do. Because the handful at the very top, they're going to run away well-heeled. Same thing is going to happen with the parking garages, because they're going to probably end up hocking those off too, because, hey, we need money on the short term. So all of this short-term decision-making, what's it doing for us? I'll tell you what it's doing for us. It's harming our ability to invest in the future. It's harming our ability to move forward and invest. You got a governor who's saying, well, you know what? We're going to invest $1.8 billion over the next 5 years on a need that's $6.5 billion. What investment is that? Well, it's none. And part of me says this is all by design. It's by design to say, hey, we put some money into it and it's still crumbled anyway. We need to privatize it. We need to profitize it. We need to, you know, we need more toll roads run by private operators in Philadelphia. And we need to sell off the popular exchanges. Well, you know, Turnpike number 226. One of the more profitable in the state system. Hey, that we could privatize that one. It's amazing what we allow them to get away with. All in the name of, I don't want to raise my taxes. Or however they say it. Anyway, going to take a quick break, right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Beyond the checklist, what else healthcare can learn from aviation teamwork and safety is a new book that explores the parallels between aviation and healthcare and how over the decades, aviation has evolved while healthcare has not. The book details how when the aviation industry was plagued with a high rate of crashes, the industry came together and developed crew resource management. The goal of CRM was to change the paradigm where the pilot was king of the plane and didn't listen to anyone else. The book argues that the United States healthcare industry, where nearly 100,000 people die due to safety issues and lack of communication, can save lives by adopting CRM. Suzanne Gordon, a co-author of the book, explains.
They teach people how to communicate. They teach people how to listen to other people. They teach people not only to listen to other people, but to solicit input from other people, which is very different from listening to other people, right? They teach people how to challenge authority.
Gordon said CRM breaks the perception that an airplane is something a pilot owns. If a first officer detects that a captain isn't acting with all of his faculties, he can take control of the situation. She said that doesn't currently exist in most surgery rooms.
If an intensive care doctor sees a surgeon making a big mistake, he can't take that patient away from the surgeon. The surgeon conceptualizes the patient as something he or she owns. It's very difficult to take control of the ship, as it were, from somebody who's taking that ship, i.e. the patient, into the ground, and it happens every day.
Gordon said the fears doctors express of CRM echo the same pilots had in the 80s. It took a concerted effort by the companies to reassure the pilots that CRM was the right thing to do.
They worked with organizational psychologists, sociolinguists, human factors researchers. They worked with the government. They worked with the union.
She said it isn't only the doctors not communicating. It's a toxic hierarchy.
In my view, in healthcare, toxic hierarchy is a gift that keeps on giving. And this total refusal to share information and to even conceptualize the need to share information.
Gordon said it may take federal regulation to change the way the healthcare industry communicates.
Federal regulations require a whole bunch of things in aviation that are not required in healthcare, so that in aviation, pretty quickly, they started training the captains of the ship, you know, the pilots, and then they started with the pilots, and then moved to the flight attendants and the ground crew and air traffic control and everything.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So while the Pennsylvania Progressive Summit was going on here in Harrisburg, put on by the folks at Keystone Progress, I had the opportunity to meet a whole bunch of really interesting folks, and we talked about this, you know, since it happened, but I got to meet a guy, a Philadelphia attorney, who's running for the Court of Common Pleas. And I thought, you know, this is exactly what we need to be talking about. How do we get progressive-minded, you know, reasonable-minded people on the bench? You look at what's going on in the Supreme Court. You look at some of these just insane decisions coming from the higher courts. And it's my thought that it's been, you know, 30 years of the right pushing their candidates into these court positions, and they've built a way up. And this whole line of thought on a lot of things, well, along with them. And I go back to our conversations on the Lochner decision, which has been taught as an abomination of law, that now you've got people like Rand Paul saying, well, we need to put new life into that and you know, maybe go back to that wonderful decision. But anyway, I've got Giovanni Campbell on the line. He's a Philadelphia attorney running for the Court of Common Pleas. Giovanni, thanks for taking time for me.
All right, thank you for having me, Rick.
So let me ask you, you know, why throw your hat into the ring to run for a judicial spot?
Well, Rick, I've been litigating for nearly 20 years, my entire career, and I've decided, I came to a decision gradually to represent people and push for equality in a different capacity. I think you can get a lot more done as judge and as an advocate.
Well, how can a judge push for equality? How can a judge do any of those things sitting on the bench?
All right. Well, you know, as you can see, you know, there's lots of room for interpretation in the laws, and trial court judges are given lots of discretion to interpret not only the law but the way it's applied. Of course, there's the review process to which the aggrieved party appeals, but by and large, you know, judges are given a whole lot of discretion, and this is why you can have the same situation end up with different results from different judges.
Isn't that why you heard a lot of people pushing for mandatory sentencing and mandatory taking control away from judges?
Well, that does. I mean, mandatory sentencing is an example of where discretion is taken away from judges to a certain extent. For example, if you have a statute that requires a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence, then no judge has the authority to give that person, if convicted, less than 5 years, right?
Right.
But using that same example, there would be the discretion to give that person as a sentence anywhere between 5 years and the statutory maximum, which could be life, could be 10 years, could be 15 years, right?
Yeah,
and of course, there are things that may factor into that analysis, like the sentencing guidelines in this example. But again, it all falls within the judge's discretion, and the decision would probably survive appellate review so long as it is well-grounded on the law and the facts that exists. But you could have the same scenario result in radically different sentences depending on who the judge is.
Man, I mean, because the Court of Common Pleas is a fairly important component of our legal system, correct?
That's correct.
Can you tell folks what exactly, as judge, you would be responsible for?
Well, it covers many things. In Philadelphia, it covers all factual disputes, all civil disputes involving $10,000 or more. It covers all family court matters, including divorces, child custody, visitation rights. There's also the family court criminal division, which covers juvenile criminal cases. And, of course, it covers adult criminal cases that get past the preliminary hearing level. And then, you know, it's mattering of other things, but those I would say are the main areas. So pretty much everything kind of depends on where the particular judge is assigned.
So what makes you a good candidate for one of these spots?
Well, aside from the fact that I've been litigating my entire career and as such, I've been in front of judges thousands of times. I've been involved in numerous trials, many of which have been long and complex, both in federal and state courts. I have a history of public service that actually precedes law school for me. But I've practiced most of my career from neighborhood locations in order to make the process a bit more accessible to the common person. And in addition to that, I've spent a whole lot of time doing pro bono work, not only independently, but in partnership with public service agencies. And I think these activities are important, particularly for someone who's going to take a bench, because judges are making decisions over people and events throughout the city, and there should be some familiarity with the people and events that they're making decisions over.
Yeah, I mean, you should be part of the community and know what and have lived their lives and know what's going on. I agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And furthermore, there are a lot of stressful situations that can arise during proceedings, and I've been through many such situations as a litigator. And I think it's very important to be able to handle those situations with cool-headedness and reasonableness. And I've developed among my peers a reputation for treating everyone with professionalism and respect, even when things become very difficult. I think it's even more important for a judge to be able to behave in that way when things are chaotic or that intense, because everyone pretty much takes the tone from the judge.
And also, you know, being able to apply the law evenly and fairly. And, you know, I remember the Supreme Court, the head of the Supreme Court saying that he would call balls and strikes based on the law, based on things that were decided. You know, the kind of question that at this point, but, you know, that idea that you're going to apply the law evenly and fairly to me is very important.
Oh, absolutely. Very important because, you know, one person might see the law one way and another person might see the law in another way. You know, the reasonable minds differ. And this is why it's one of the reasons why we have so many judges in Philadelphia. And I think you made a reference to the fact that the Tea Party type thinkers have stacked up the offices with people who think like them, right?
Yep.
One of the good things about us having this many Court of Common Pleas court judges in Philadelphia is that we have an opportunity to populate the bench with people of different perspectives.
And I think that's extremely important, and I'm glad to see that thought is going into this. You listen to the Rick Smith Show with Giovanni Campbell. He's running for the Court of Common Pleas. He's got a Facebook page, facebook.com/friendsofGiovanniCampbell. Also, Giovanni Campbell for the number 4 judge.com. We've got a link at the ricksmithshow.com so you can get to those places. Just click on Giovanni's name. It'll take you right there. You know, in that vein of thought, you know, one of the things that's caught my attention the last week or so since Rand Paul brought it up in his spiel during his filibusters, this idea that we need to revisit the days of Lochner, which is to use the court, to use, you know, the law as a bridge between saying, hey, you can't have maximum hour laws, you can't have minimum wage laws, you can't have laws that won't allow children in the mines. And to me, it seems, well, it seems just dumb to me, and it seems that, you know, since then our nation has gotten so much better and prosperity has grown by so much. To go back to those days just seems, well, stupid to me.
Yeah, it's utterly unjustifiable. I mean, if just the very fact that someone would have to go back to something that is not only archaic but was expressly repealed and used as an example in law school. It says a lot. It says a lot. It's not only ridiculous, but it really shows how far apart we are in ideology.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, it's important for me to say, you know what, these judicial positions are extraordinarily important. This is why we need to get out in the off-year elections and in the midterm elections, because the positions of common pleas judge and local county commissioner and local supervisor, those are the positions that affect us the most. Those are the positions that affect my life every single day. And while the presidency may be a sexy election to go cast your ballot in, it doesn't really play as much as common pleas judge or county commissioner.
Certainly. Common pleas court judges affect people's lives in a very direct way. Every day, common pleas court judges are making decisions about whether someone gets to keep or have custody of their child, whether someone gets to keep a home from being forfeited, whether someone is able to do business in a particular area. You know,
or if they can send kids off to a juvenile detention center for huge profit.
Exactly. Excellent example. Yes.
And, you know, I think it's important that you have people who are honest, who are dedicated, who understand the law and are willing to fight for, in my view, to stand up for the little guy. Because too often we see the courts applied unevenly. And we see this whole idea of justice being applied in an unequal fashion. The more money you have, the better outcomes you generally get. And I just saw something the other day that these sequester cuts that are coming out are harming the public defender's office at a much greater rate than the prosecutor's office. So here again, our constitutional right to that speedy trial, to fair, to representation, maybe not so much an absolute right anymore.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that makes it all the more important for the judge to be cognizant of this. Cognizant not only because he is experienced enough to see the differences under the law, but also have enough of a connection or regard for the common man to act when he sees that difference. Act in a way that promotes equality, even in a setting that may not necessarily offer equality to both sides.
No, I mean, because for me, I can't ask you specifics. What would you do in this case? Because you don't know. It's not in front of you, and I would be suspect if you would say, well, this is what I would do in this situation, because you don't know, because you don't have everything in front of you.
That's exactly right. But I can tell you that what I would do is I would try to do what is fair under the law, and as the facts are presented to me, the way I view the facts, pursuant to my common sense and life experience, right? And to treat everyone the way I would like to be treated.
You know, I look at myself. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I saw people, you know, basically run through the system, and without representation, without any care or concern, they were just railroaded. They were ran right through. And you could say railroad, you could say whatever, but it didn't appear to me that the system even cared about them. And, you know, in looking at a judge or someone who's going to run for one of these positions, which I know you are, Giovanni, and the website, if you want more information on Giovanni, is Giovanni Campbell, the number 4judge.com. We've got a link at the RickSmithShow.com. But I look at this, and I want somebody who's going to look at these people as human beings and not just another case number.
Exactly. And you're right. You know, often the system does not treat everyone fairly. But let's remember that the system, at least small parts of it, we can see it's made up of people, right? And the judge is one of those key people. And while no one judge could change the system, certainly one judge can change the way things work out in a particular courtroom. And yep. A whole lot happens in one particular courtroom every single day.
And maybe we could find a judge who'd have the courage to stand up and say, you know what, to all you people who've been foreclosing on these folks with these bad contracts, not going to happen anymore. Not until you cross your T's and dot your I's. I've been waiting for that. I'm still hopeful.
I'm hopeful, too.
Again, Giovanni Campbell for the number 4judge.com. We've got a link at the ricksmithshow.com. He's also got a Facebook page, facebook.com/friendsofGiovanniCampbell. Giovanni, last question. What can people do to help? Do you need resources, bodies on the ground, knuckles on the doors, what?
Oh, I need all of that. If you would please visit the website and also the Facebook page, Giovanni Campbell for Judge, you would see a form that people can fill out and choose a way in which they would like to participate in the campaign or contribute to it. And please vote on May 21st, people who live in Philadelphia. Or spread the word to friends that are eligible voters in Philadelphia, Democrats, of course. Those are all the ways that you can help.
Outstanding. We will make sure that our listeners in Philadelphia get the message and hopefully get out there and knock on doors and spread the word. Giovanni Campbell, I appreciate the time.
I appreciate the opportunity, Rick. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Again, Giovanni Campbell for the number 4judge.com, facebook.com/friendsofGiovanniCampbell. We've got links at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
In a recent senatorial dust-up, Senator John McCain dubbed his Republican colleague Rand Paul one of the, quote, wacko birds in Congress. McCain, who sometimes appears not too tightly wrapped himself, was giving Senator Paul a tongue-lashing for having mounted a 13-hour, old-fashioned, standalone filibuster over the possibility that murderous drones could be used for targeted assassinations of Americans right here at home. McCain said that the Kentucky senator's talkathon had veered into, quote, the realm of the ridiculous, adding that, I don't think it is helpful to the American people. I hate to interrupt when one Republican Solon is hammering another, but I'm siding with Rand Paul. While plenty of the Tea Party senators' extreme right-wing stands are wacko, this isn't one of them. Unfortunately for America, powerful corporate interests are eager to reap billions in profit from the spread of drones across our land, and police agencies at all levels are drooling at the prospect of adding weaponized fleets of drones to their arsenals. Indeed, what's ridiculous is that other Congress critters have not been paying attention, speaking out, and taking action. Call it grandstanding if you want, but at least Paul took an actual stand. And, contrary to McCain's opinion, it was quite helpful to the American people. Thanks to Paul's attention-getting combination of principle, ego, and chutzpah, the great majority of Americans heard for the first time that these inherently invasive, liberty-busting, and potentially deadly drones are on the verge of being deployed domestically. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's why the Congressional Progressive Caucus and such alert Democrats as Senator Ron Wyden have joined in sounding the alarm and demanding a full public debate on the cost to our democracy before we let profiteers unleash this technology on us. As Senator Paul says, at least we need to know what are the rules.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
We can't live in the wealthiest economy in the world, the richest nation in the world. world and treat our workers like they're from the third world. Corporations are making profits hand over fist. They're sitting on tens of billions of dollars in cash that they refuse to put back into the economy. They're suppressing workers. They're preventing them from being able to support their families.
Question, when are we going to wake up from all of this? When are we going to wake up from, oh, yeah, let's, you know, I had one of these conversations at church this Sunday. Our church celebrated its 250th anniversary and had a nice luncheon afterwards. And we, you know, we went down to the, you know, to the luncheon afterwards. And, you know, and I hate being in these settings because it always, something politically always comes up. And then my wife gives me that evil look that she does, you know, kind of shut up and don't ruin this day for me. Because we're here among friends, and they, you know, they all know what you do, and they all know you're insane. And so I end up having this really nice long conversation with this guy who's a retired military guy. And, you know, he's in the military for, you know, 27 years. Just, you know, retired, now works for the federal government in the healthcare part of the barracks in the area. And, you know, he's saying, well, you know, there's some things we should be doing. We just had this really, really nice talk. And a lot of it was about healthcare, and, you know, he seemed to believe that, you know, we could privatize the system and it would be better, even though the example that he used, which is TRICARE, didn't work as anticipated. It hasn't resulted in worse care. It's just been more expensive and a whole bunch of roadblocks and stuff in the way, but that's a whole discussion for another day. You know, and the more I talk to him, the more he started going, you know, I think I see things a little bit differently. And he kept bringing up, you know, understand, here's a guy who does not, and he, admittedly, he doesn't listen to any talk radio. He doesn't listen to this program. He didn't even know this one existed. The talk radio that he's heard is the right-wing extreme stuff, which he just said is, you know, it's just stuff to make me angry and to, you know, to get me all riled up and hate my government. And, you know, I look at this and I go, well, that's what the right wing is supposed to do. That's their calling. That's their mission. That's the idea. So that we give up and throw control over to the big multinational corporations so that they can run things. And then everything will be quiet and nice and calm. But he kept throwing out this statement saying, well, I just want them to balance the budget. I just want them to balance the budget. I just want them to pay their bills and balance the budget. And even he goes, you know, all of these crises that they keep throwing up, I don't know if they're real or if they're made up. You know, all I care about is that they do what we do at the kitchen table. And I asked him, I said, you know, since 1980, do you know how many balanced budgets we've had? Because he had the view, like a lot of people, that, you know, we used to have balanced budgets all the time. And now it's only been since Obama that, well, no balanced budget. And I said, in the years since 1980 till now, there have been two balanced budgets, and they were both during the Clinton years. All the rest of the budgets ran deficits, which is why we have this mounting debt. And I'm with you. You pay your bills, but not during a time of crisis. And beyond that, you raise revenue. So as we're having this conversation and you know, the light is coming on, you're going, you know, tax rates for the very wealthy have never been lower. Tax rates for multinational corporations have never been lower. Tax rates for the very wealthy, for the big corporations, the people who have all the money, think about it. There's an opportunity to balance our budget by raising some revenue. And even some Republicans, and I said, look, you know, the reality is not all the Republicans are bad and not all the Democrats are good. Most of them are cut from the same cloth and they eat at the same trough. So on Sunday, you saw Bob Corker, the Republican senator from Tennessee, who was on Fox News Sunday. And he was asked by Chris Wallace if any compromise could be made, anything could be brokered that would include some tax increases. And Corker said, yeah, I think Republicans, if they saw true entitlement reform, would be glad to look at a tax reform that generates additional revenue. And he said that doesn't mean increasing rates. It means closing loopholes. So they're not looking at increasing the rate that, now understand, you know, during the good socialist years of Dwight David Eisenhower, that top marginal rate was 92%. Just down, you know, about 39.6 now. We're talking a huge difference. Even during the Reagan years, it was still 50% when he got to cut it from 70 down to 50. And then down to 28, which George H.W. Bush said, oh my God, the sky is falling, we got to raise it back up. This idea that we can close it through cutting loopholes and we can close our deficit problems through cutting entitlements, you know, going after grandma. Some Republicans think that's the way we're going to be able to do it. Now, the House Majority Whip Kevin McCarthy really quickly jumped all over that. He was on Meet the Depressed where he said there are no new tax increases. Nothing. Because you don't need it. We're going to cut, gut, and punish. We're going to slash Social Security. We're going to go after all of that. Because that's the goal. That is the end result. And I liked, you know, I got to be honest, when Boehner was on with George Stephanopoulos, because you'll remember the president last week said that, you know, we don't face an immediate debt crisis. There's no crisis. There's nothing immediate. We're not going to be Greece. We're not going to be Spain. We're not going to be Cyprus. We're not going to be those people. So when Boehner was on with Martha Raddatz, saying that, well, we don't have an immediate debt crisis, but we all know one's looming. I agreed with him. We don't have a debt crisis. Nothing immediate. Now, down the road, could we potentially? I'm sure. But if you look at the projections, we're fairly stable for at least the next decade. Things are going to remain right about where we are or even fall below where we are, which is right around the 77% range, which economists say anything below 90% is okay. So when I go back to my conversation that I had with the guy I was talking to at lunch, you know, you explain that. Look, we've got a fairly decent debt-to-GDP ratio. I didn't get to ask him what his was, but, you know, the reality is most people have a much higher debt-to-GDP ratio than the federal government's got, which blows people's mind when you start talking about kitchen table economics. But the cuts that they're talking about over the next 10 years would gut government spending down to historic lows and the investment that we would put into tomorrow. Because we understand, look, we get it. Austerity kills. Austerity is going to cripple our economic growth. Austerity is going to screw this country up. And we've seen it already through more cuts through public investment, through more cuts to public sector workforce. And what they've done, and this guy, you know, I said, look, you know, the reality is federal employees haven't seen a raise in the last several years. And they're probably not for the next couple of years. But he said, look, if it was going to help the country, I'd be okay with it. The sad thing is, it's going to harm the country. And I look at all of the diversion and all of the things that we haven't been talking about over the last couple of years. We've been stuck on this we're broke mentality. We've been stuck on this we need to cut things mentality when in fact we need to be investing in things. You know, stop and think about it, and this is where I love to throw the business idea back on my conservative friends. Show me one business that is not investing in what it's doing, through new equipment, through better education for their employees, better investment in infrastructure, better logistics plans, better computer systems, advertising, any of that. Show me a company that's not doing those things, and I'll show you one that's dying. I'll show you one that's on their way out the door. And you look at, you know, the right loves to throw up Bethlehem Steel as an example. See what happens when the union destroys? No, that wasn't the union anything to do with that. That was a business model made on, hey, we're going to be able to produce steel like we are right now forever. We don't have to upgrade our equipment. We can use the same antiquated stuff that we have used for the last 100 years. We can take the profit and go buy hotels. We can take the profit and go buy golf courses. We can take the profit and give huge CEO and executive bonuses. We can take that profit and we can give vacations to the executives and use the plane for their families and also many wonderful things for them, but not reinvesting in their core business. Now, understand that from a business model, because I've yet to find anyone who disagrees with me on that point. Okay? So I've yet to find anyone. And if you disagree, I'd love to hear from you. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Because look, the same people who are telling us we need to treat government like a business are the same ones who are saying we need to stop investing in our infrastructure, stop investing in computers and things for state government, and stop investing in the future of state government. We need to cut. And we need to freeze the wages and push people out the door who have the experience to do the job. Now, if I'm running a business, is that the way to successfully run a business? And before I take a break, real quick, something just popped into my head. I go to some of these big conferences, and I run into the same woman over at the Department of Treasury who goes around and tries to get people to sign up for the college plans, the 529 plans, which, as I understand, are pretty good. She has said that, and she told me this on more than one occasion, that they wanted to do a webinar. They wanted to, you know, instead of sending her to all of these things, they wanted to try and do some online things just like that. So she wouldn't have to spend the whole day. She could spend maybe 45 minutes, a half hour, whatever, giving her spiel and trying to connect on the web. Evidently, according to her, the state's computers, the computers that state government uses, is so antiquated that the guy who was trying to help her set up this webinar said that in order for her to use the computers that they've got and the system that they've got, it would be like a grandson trying to relate to his great-great-grandfather. That's how outdated and how antiquated the equipment is. So I go back to that frame. We need to run like a business. If we need to run like a business, don't we need to invest in our business? Don't we need to invest in what we, the people, do for ourselves? And back to that business frame, would we sell off our very profitable assets for pennies on the dollar? And I go back to the state's wine and spirit shops. I go back to the lottery system, which has been named one of the best in the country, best operated lottery systems in the country. Just a thought. And I think a good one. One we should probably consider a little more often. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU, financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Sanity, fresh age. The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, we take care of our own. I would love to believe that in a lot of cases. But you look at the numbers that we saw last week, and there was a report that came out last week that showed here in Pennsylvania, the nursing homes across our Commonwealth pocketed in profit about $500 million. Now understand, that's $500 million that's supposed to be going into caring for our elderly, caring for our grandparents and our parents. $500 million, where did it go? Not to doing that. So today you saw nursing home care workers from across the state converge on the Capitol. Well, to one, tell their stories, but to two, stand up for the people that they take care of and say, hey, you know that $500 million that was supposed to go for caring for your grandparents and your parents that isn't? We demand that it is, which is why I've asked Donna Heimbach. She's a certified nurse's assistant. She was in the Capitol today talking to legislators, so I've asked her on the program. Donna, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.
So I guess the first question I have for you is what do you do for our seniors? What do you do for our parents and grandparents?
Well, as a certified nurse's aide, I do everything for them, from bathing, dressing, feeding, vital signs. This is endless. They're like our second family.
Yeah, so who are these folks? You know, I think of my grandmother who's 84 years old who, you know, fortunately she's still living on her own with some help to stay in her own home. But, you know, there's going to be a point down the road where she's going to need to perhaps go somewhere. I want to make sure that those are decent places.
Yeah, I mean, we have a rehab in our facility too. Most of my residents are long-term residents that are there that can't do it sometimes a thing for themselves. Others, you know, they just need a little bit of assistance. It just depends.
And, you know, that's got to be, I go back to my childhood, and my mother worked in a nursing home for a number of years, and I remember that, you know, the folks that were there, you know, they didn't have, you know, family or friends to come visit. They were pretty much on their own, and I remember as a kid, you know, visiting with these folks and just remembering, you know, it was the workers who were there were basically their family.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're our second family. We do their birthdays. We do their holidays.
So, you know, what are the conditions that are in our nursing homes right now as someone who's on the inside?
The biggest problem is staffing. These poor residents are not getting the quality of care they need because we just don't have the adequate staff. That is one of our big legislatures we have coming out now. You know, we're trying to fight for some quality care for these people because they deserve it.
So $500 million last year, as the report pointed out, that was supposed to, that we're paying, we think we're paying to care for our seniors that went somewhere else. What do you think that $500 million could have done if we were actually spending it where we think we're spending it?
We wouldn't be using faulty products, you know. They would have more time for different activities. They'd actually have a nurse's aide to have more than 10 minutes of their time for these people. Sometimes I take care of 10, 12, 14 people a day. I work 7.5 hours, rations out to about 15 minutes to even do personal care. So it would have added extra staff to the building. It would have changed everything.
So what can you do in 10 or 15 minutes? You know, I got to be honest. You know, I think about myself just to, you know, to brush my teeth and to take a shower and do those things. That takes longer than 10 or 15 minutes in a day.
Yes, it does. And it is. And I mean, we do everything, feeding, dressing, vital signs, therapies, appointments. It's just endless. It's just nonstop. We seriously run for 7.5 hours the whole entire time we're there.
And what kind of, you know, I think of this and I go back to my mother who, you know, who she just loved the people that she took care of. And, you know, she would spend time with them, talk with them, because, you know, that's care as well. Being part of, you know, discussing their day, discussing what their wants and their thoughts are. That's part of it. I can't imagine in 10 or 15 minutes that you'd have any time for that.
No, we do a lot of that after hours, after we've already clocked off. That, you know, we clock out of work and then we take our residents for the walk in the courtyard. Or, you know, we take our lunch hours, or because they need that. They need that reaction, you know, interaction with you. They trust you and you want to build up that relationship with them. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, my fear in this is that, one, we've moved to a profit model where we've evidently $500 million that we think we're spending on taking care of our grandparents and parents, not going to the actual care. But beyond this, it seems to me, and what worries me, is that it now becomes a situation where we're just warehousing people.
Right, exactly. A body in a bed.
And that, I don't think, is good for anyone.
No, it isn't. And you know, that's why we were there today. You know, we want some things changed. We have three legislations going on right now. You know, hopefully that someone's going to listen to us. If we speak loud enough and speak all together, eventually someone's going to have to listen.
So you were in the Capitol. They had a rally I saw on the steps. What did you do after the rally? I assume you went in and talked with the legislators.
Yes, we did. We each had a list, and we had different legislators that were from our regions, and then just anybody. Anybody we could get to listen, we went in. We handed them copies of our legislation. We handed them, you know, we took the business cards and made them pay attention today. So hopefully somebody listened.
What kind of who did you meet with, if you can tell me?
The only actual representative we got to meet was Corman.
Okay.
Because everyone else was in, you know, in an office or anything like that, or going down to the floor. We just had really bad timing today. But we did have a sit down with Corman and his aide. So that was pretty productive.
And what kind of response did you get from him?
Well, he, tried to brush us off, but that didn't go all that well. So we sat down and we told him our piece, and he listened. He listened as long as he could, and he apologized that he had to go. So we're just going to make sure we go see him in his local office on Thursday.
And that's where I think things have to go back to. You know, you start, you go knocking on people's doors where they are, and the person you're talking about is Jake Corman, correct? The Republican from the 34th District. I guess that's Center and Juniata counties, Mifflin, Perry, and Union County. So, you know, somewhere in our listening area, he's one of the senators in that area.
Yeah, exactly.
So the response was just kind of, yeah, we'll take the information and move along. You didn't get any real commitments out of him?
Well, yeah, at first, until we kind of just let him know that we weren't going to leave. And then he did, you know, kind of sit down and did apologize after about a few minutes of hearing what we had to say. He seemed interested, I'm not going to lie. But then he said he had to go. So we just said, okay, we'll see you Thursday. So.
Well, good. I mean, because at the end of this is just the beginning of this whole process. You know, in talking with other folks through the Capitol today, did you get any sense that they're upset with the idea of $500 million? Because it's a lot of money, in my view, of money that I think I'm spending on taking care of our most vulnerable, and yet it's not being spent there.
I just think they have no clue what happens. I do. I just think they're clueless. They have no idea what happens in a nursing home. We asked the you know, Corman's right-hand man in there, if he's ever been in a nursing home. Do you have any idea what we do? And I don't think they do. That's why we were putting a personal message to it today.
And that's why it's important to tell your story, because, you know, I remember, you know, it was not a high-paying gig when my mother was doing it back in the early and mid-70s, and I can't imagine that it's a high-paying gig today.
No, it sure isn't. And there are some nursing homes in our regions that the beds are empty and staffing is getting cut on a daily basis. You know, not only are they not given quality care, they're not getting it.
That's outrageous. You know, but I look at this and I go back to all the money that we think we're spending on it, and it's not happening.
That's exactly why we want them held accountable. That's one of the main three things we have for our legislation coming up.
So walk me through the legislation as you know it. You say there are three things. One, obviously, is we want to know where the money's spent, where that $500 million
is. We want them held accountable, yes.
And what else is in there?
The increase in nurse aid staffing. Right now, each resident gets 2.7 nursing hours a day. We want 2.1 of those hours for bedside care, hands-on care, the CNAs that are giving them the time and the quality of care that they need. We want the 2.1 for bedside, not for an RN or a physical therapist. When you work in a facility, your 2.7 hours includes all this staffing that barely sees the residents. We want 2.1 of that for the CNAs.
And that sounds like, you know, then you could probably give the care that's needed and build that personal relationship that I think is vital. Not just, you know, to be able to do your job and to do it better, but to actually have that relationship with that person that they look forward to that every day and give them something to look forward to tomorrow.
Exactly, and then that will actually increase staffing, which will decrease resident staff ratio. So right now I take care of 10 to 12. We had one extra girl, I'm down to, what, 8. That's like a huge difference.
That is a huge difference. Now let me ask you about the place where you're working. You don't have to give the name, but, you know, is this a place that's run by the state? Is this a place that's run by a for-profit corporation?
It's a for-profit corporation.
A for-profit. So we know where some of that $500 million is going. It's going to CEO pay and executive bonuses, I would assume.
Exactly.
So I would assume that, you know, your CEO makes a pretty penny.
Oh, yeah. They made a pretty big bank off of my building alone last year.
And I would assume that the workers there, not so much. Like my mother. My mother made just a little bit above minimum wage back in during that time period, which, you know, wasn't all that much money back then.
Yeah. It's barely enough to get by. It's barely enough to take care of the family you have at home.
Because I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you're taking care of our family, of our parents and our grandparents. You know, what's your situation while you're out caring for someone else's family? What's your family situation like?
Yeah, well, I'm a single mother. You know, I have a 17-year-old son. I'm a grandmother. You know, I'm an aunt. And I miss a lot because I'm always at work. But that's the only way to get ahead is to work the extra hour. And then I stay, too, because of my residence. If I don't take care of them, no one's going to be there.
Yeah. You know, we just saw a study that came out for congressmen in D.C. and you know, how they miss, you know, their family and they work long hours and it's such a stressful, difficult job. And my take on it was, well, that's all fine, well and good. But what about people like you, Donna? What about people who are struggling to make ends meet, who are doing what I consider to be God's work, taking care of, you know, my grandmother and parents and the most vulnerable in our state, and yet they can't make ends meet?
Exactly. It's a struggle every day. It's like, what do? Do you, you know, we have our building has a lot of high seniority. I mean, I work with ladies, it's been there 30 some years. Some days it's like, do I do this or do I buy my medicine? And that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, and to me, it blows my mind that, you know, someone who is in the position of taking care of these folks, they're not taking care of themselves.
Right. Exactly.
And it seems to be kind of a self-defeating proposition that we've heaped not on you but also on the system, because if you're worried about how you're going to take care of yourself and your family at home, how can you put everything into taking care of the people that need you the most?
Exactly. It's very stressful. It's hard to handle.
So what can we do to help? Well, you know, I go back to you brought up the legislation. What can we do to help push this through?
Talk to your local representatives, you know, beat their doors, call them, you know, let them know that these three things are coming. We actually have another part of the legislation that's coming up, and it's to reduce the turnover. We, our job is not easy. We have a lot of people that come to our job and think, hey, I'm going to go play bingo with grandma, you know, and it's hard work. It's backbreaking.
Yep.
It's hard work. So we can't seem to retain employment, you know. Nobody wants to work anymore. Everyone wants something handed to them. So it gets very hard just to keep the building staffed. So we want them held accountable. We want them every 3 months to report the turnover, to find out where the problem is. And we also want them held accountable. We want to know that they spend at least 95% that these people are getting on the residents. We want proof.
I'm right there with you. That sounds fantastic. I would like to make sure that the money that I think I'm spending on taking care of people is actually being spent on taking care of people.
Exactly. That's why Thursday we have a huge action going on. We have over 50 different nursing homes. It's the biggest action in our union. It's our day of action. It's the 21st. We'll be outside of every one of our facilities sharing our support for quality care and quality jobs.
I mean, and the thing is, you know, you hear this, and I think your union is doing a fantastic job of this, because if you weren't, who would?
Exactly. We would be ignored.
And, you know, a lot can be thrown at this saying, well, you know, you're just thinking about yourself. But the way I see this is, if you can't take care of yourself at home, how are you going to be able to take care of the people that you're taking care of, my grandparents and parents' generation? And what is that good for them? And as you pointed out, the high turnover rate, you don't want that. You want people who know the job, who are going to do it well, and who care about what they're doing and can take care of themselves and their families as well. So that you have continuity of care, you have a system that is in place and that is stable, and those relationships are stable.
Exactly. That's all we ask for. I don't think it's much.
I don't think it's much at all, but, you know, and I go back to, you know, the responses that you would get from these legislators, and that's why I was curious. You said Corman was half decent. I would be curious to find out what some of the other folks had to say.
We really didn't get it. I mean, I know other groups were more successful than ours. The list that we had, actually, we just missed Adam Harris, which, you know, we visited his office in town, so, you know, it wasn't such a loss. He kind of knows where we stand, and we'll just get to him, and then the other groups were very successful. So I think, you know, we opened some eyes today, I believe.
Yeah. Well, no, that's what has to happen, because I truly believe that once you start putting pressure on these folks, no matter what side of the issue they think they're on at this moment, you start telling people what's going on, $500 million that we think we're spending taking care of folks going into the hands of the profiteers and these big executives, people start to come around real quick. And when that
exactly.
happens and you start putting a little pressure on these legislators, they tend to change their mind a little bit.
Yeah, we're putting a personal side to it, you know. We're putting a face on it. So it's not like it's someone they don't know. You know, we're out there saying, hey, this is our story. This is what we're doing. You know, this is our daily struggle. Not only to take care of them, but to take care of ourselves. You know, not only our residents deserve quality care, but we deserve quality jobs.
Absolutely. And that, you know what, because you brought up the high turnover rate. You know, the best way to have a lower turnover rate? Make sure.
Oh, sorry. What did you say?
You know how to make sure you have a low turnover rate. Make sure the jobs that people can live on. They have decent health care.
Exactly.
Retirement.
Pay us.
Exactly.
Pay us what we deserve. You know.
It seems very simple to me, Donna.
Yeah.
But I appreciate your time. I appreciate the input, and we'd love to have you come back and tell us how this is progressing down the road.
Oh, I sure will.
Donna Heinbeck, thanks so much. Certified Nurses Assistant. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
This is why we fight, why we lie away. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
On March 13, 2013, the ALMA telescope in the Atacama Desert in northern Chile officially came online. ALMA stands for Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. This telescope will be able to see the universe in a resolution 10 times greater than that of the Hubble Space Telescope. Allison Peck, ALMA Deputy Project Scientist, explained that the altitude, 16,500 feet or 5,000 meters, and the dry desert climate of ALMA's location help make it so powerful.
The main enemy of millimeter or submillimeter astronomy is not light like it is for optical telescopes, but rather water. Having a location like this, high in the mountains, up in the desert, means that your sensitivity is much, much greater than it would be anywhere else in the world.
Though not the first telescope of its kind, it's the fastest and most powerful. ALMA will penetrate clouds of dust and gas to help astronomers study the birth of planets, stars, and galaxies in the near and distant universe.
Things that have never been detectable before, things that appear dark to optical telescopes, will be detectable with ALMA.
The ALMA array, consisting of six large radio dishes connected together, will allow astronomers to look 12 billion years back in time. For more on the ALMA telescope, come to EarthSky.org and search ALMA. That's A-L-M-A. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
In fact, I was in a meeting in Wall Street, Rick, and it was a pretty stunning meeting because we were talking with them about, you know, how can we get more private investment in infrastructure? And they said, pay us. And you have to pay us not just the cost of the capital, like, you know, $60 million to rebuild I-80. You got to pay us for the profit that we would lose by putting that money elsewhere.
Oh,
in one nice, neat little sentence, Donna Cooper laid out exactly why privatization will not work, why privatization is a bad idea. This idea that we're going to attract private capital, and just for the good of, just for the wonder and the wonder and the good of the community is nonsensical. It's ridiculous. It's stupid. And this whole push towards privatizing education because, oh, you know, it's those greedy teachers who are standing against these benevolent, you know, these philanthropic, benevolent billionaires because they just care. They care about kids. In fact, you know, the billionaires, the Rupert Murdochs and the Bill Gates, they care about children a lot more than those greedy teachers who all they care about is their pay and their pensions. That's all they care about. They don't care about those kids. That's the frame, man. That's it right there. Pushed by the benevolent, philanthropic billionaires. And, you know, they use these front groups, and I don't know if you saw it on Friday, but on Friday I thought the American Legislative Exchange Council did a brilliant thing. I've always said, you know, whenever, if I were president and someone would say, we want an information, we want to know this or that, then you just flood them with stuff. Okay, here's a 48-foot trailer full of documents. And somewhere in the middle would be what you're looking for, probably more in the nose. Somewhere in there is what you're looking for. Here's your haystack. Find your needle. Well, that's basically what the American Legislative Exchange Council did on Friday. They dumped hundreds of pieces of their model legislation, put it right online, because there are a lot of groups saying, hey, we want you to be more transparent. You know, people like the Center for Media and Democracy, who did the ALEC Exposed website, and, you know, a number of other groups, Common Cause, People for the American Way, you know, a whole bunch of progress now, a bunch of groups calling saying, hey, we want more transparency. We'd like to know who are the legislators who are you've bought and got in your pocket. I haven't seen that list yet, but a list of all of the legislation, maybe not all of it, but about 100 and some bills that they're pushing around the country. You know, stuff on right to works, you know, that whole no right to work agenda, the charter schools, you know, they're big under the charter schools. You know, just stuff to benefit them and the people, the billionaires who fund them over us. And I look at the charter school stuff, of which there were several pieces of legislation that they're promoting across the country under the guise of, we care. Because the billionaires say that, you know, they just care about the future generation, care about our kids. And as I've been saying, look, this whole push towards charters, this whole push towards vouchers, all of this privatization is a ripoff. And as the old man always said, you know, when a billionaire or a rich guy is going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. Public education, we better fight for. Because the billionaire money, the messaging money is going into, well, we need more privatization. And if we lose it, we don't get it back. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break back with hour three. Stick around. If you missed any portion of the program, RickSmithShow.com or Stitcher on the smartphone. Quick break.
Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Here's today's headlines from Workers Independent News. I'm Jesse Russell. Beyond the checklist, What Else Healthcare Can Learn from Aviation Teamwork and Safety is a new book that explores the parallels between aviation and healthcare and how over the decades, aviation has evolved while healthcare has not. The book details how when the aviation industry was plagued with a high rate of crashes, the industry came together and developed crew resource management. The goal of CRM was to change the paradigm where the pilot was king of the plane and didn't listen to anyone else. The book argues that the United States healthcare industry, where nearly 100,000 people die due to safety issues and lack of communication, can save lives by adopting CRM. Suzanne Gordon, a co-author of the book, explains.
They teach people how to communicate. They teach people how to listen to other people. They teach people not only to listen to other people, but to solicit input from other people, which is very different from listening to other people, right? They teach people how to challenge authority.
Gordon said CRM breaks the perception that an airplane is something a pilot owns. If a first officer detects that a captain isn't acting with all of his faculties, he can take control of the situation. She said that doesn't currently exist in most surgery rooms.
If an intensive care doctor sees a surgeon making a big mistake, he can't take that patient away from the surgeon. The surgeon conceptualizes the patient as something he or she owns. It's very difficult to take control of the ship, as it were, from somebody who's taking that ship, i.e. the patient, into the ground, and it happens every day.
Gordon said the fears doctors express of CRM echo the same pilots had in the 80s. It took a concerted effort by the companies to reassure the pilots that CRM was the right thing to do.
They worked with organizational psychologists, sociolinguists, human factors researchers. They worked with the government. They worked with the union.
She said it isn't only the doctors not communicating. It's a toxic hierarchy.
In my view, in healthcare, toxic hierarchy is a gift that keeps on giving. And this total refusal to share information and to even conceptualize the need to share information.
Gordon said it may take federal regulation to change the way the healthcare industry communicates.
Federal regulations require a whole bunch of things in aviation that are not required in healthcare. So that in aviation, pretty quickly, they started training the captains of the ship, you know, the pilots, and then they started with the pilots and then moved to the flight attendants and the ground crew and air traffic control and everything.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I've got a golden chance to make my way. And with a golden ticket, it's a golden day.
Ah, yes, if only we could all have one of those golden tickets, those vouchers. If we could just have one for education, it would be wonderful. If we could have one for health care, even better. This wonderful, shiny piece of paper that would say that you're entitled to, well, nothing. You're entitled to this piece of paper. Because all of the voucher schemes that I've seen, and I've asked numerous people, especially in our General Assembly, the voucher, will I be able to send my kids to the Abington Friends School? $30,000 a year. Well, no. Then where's my golden ticket? Well, you can send it to somewhere else if you can get in. Ah, the healthcare thing, remember that? Oh, we'll give you a little bit, and then you'll have to pay the rest. And I love this whole framing of these vouchers are the golden, this is the wonderful stuff. It's the future. And what they've done is they've done masterfully is they've made this education debate, this whole push towards privatization, a situation between the greedy, evil teachers who just want pay and pension and benevolent, philanthropic billionaires who just care about the welfare of our children. They wouldn't possibly, they have enough money. Money's unimportant to them. And if you believe that, I've got a golden voucher to sell you. But what I think we have to do, and I've said for the longest time, education is the hill that we in the working class must die on. And when I see people around the country doing things that I think right direction, things maybe we should think about emulating here in our neck of the woods, I got to talk to them, which is why I've asked Marilyn Schenck, board member at the Indiana Coalition for Public Education. Marilyn, thanks for taking time for me.
Hello. Glad to be here.
You know, I look at this whole push towards privatization of education as not only destructive and profit-seeking for the very wealthy, but the hill that working people in this country should have to die on, because this is the opportunity, the chance to get into the middle class and maybe above. So taking this away, this opportunity away to me seems not only bad policy, but dumb.
I would agree.
So what are you guys in Indiana doing? Because I understand there's some legislation that they're pushing there that would not only use the money, because we're talking about charter schools here, funding with public dollars, but in your neck of the woods, actually funding religious schools fairly heavily.
Absolutely. Indiana passed its voucher law in 2011, so we've been living with it now for 2 years. When they put it through, there were some lower income limits, there were some limits on who could use them, and there was also a limit to how many there would be in the first year and in the second year, which is what we're in now. By year three, a lot of those regulations, the cap is going to go away, but every year we've seen since then in the General Assembly, they try to eat away at it a little bit more. Oh, let's take away this restriction. Oh, let's raise the income limit a little bit more. So one of the conditions initially is that you have to have been in a public school before you can request a voucher, and now they're trying to take that away as well. So pretty much it would just be a ticket that anybody could go and get a voucher if all of these strictures are taken off and the bills before the General Assembly right now are passed, which we hope they are not.
Yeah, but, you know, the frame that I love, and I get this a lot from people, because it's about choice. It's about consumers. And I should have the choice to send my child anywhere I want to send them.
And that is a nice thing to say, but it isn't necessarily a reality. And I would say in many places you have a lot of choice in your public schools now. You have magnet programs. You have specialized programs for kids of different interests. And in Indiana, you can even choose what public school districts you go to. And so you have a lot of choice within the public school system. So you don't necessarily have to have vouchers to have a choice about your education.
No, I'm right there with you. But I look at this, and according to this release that I've seen, some 98% of the people participating in these vouchers, the money is going to these religious schools, which, you know, part of me says, which is why here in Pennsylvania, we haven't heard the religious community really come out on the privatization of our liquor stores, because part of me goes, the quid pro quo is, we'll get you vouchers and we'll get you some money like they're getting in Indiana.
Well, I don't know about the quid pro quo on that issue, but I do know that there were a lot of religious schools that were suffering. They were on the verge of closing. They didn't have full enrollment. They needed money like everybody else. And to have these vouchers has been very nice for the religious schools.
Could we say it was...
Even though you heard that the majority of the schools that were voucher eligible were religious schools, until you see the list, it is astounding that, you know, the Tony private school that people hold out there as saying, oh, your voucher can buy you an education there, they're not on the list. It's 98% religious schools and then 6% some others. But the top schools are not going to take vouchers.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this, and you're right. You're not going to get to those top schools. You're not going to get to the schools where Rahm Emanuel and the president send their kids. But, you know, I look at this, and I guess the question then becomes is, could you make the argument that what they've done in Indiana is a bailout of the religious schools?
I think that case is being made. And actually, there is a lawsuit that is before the Indiana Supreme Court that would ask to have our voucher law thrown out on that basis, in that we are sending tax money to schools that teach religion, that teach creationism, and that don't have to obey the same rules as public schools.
And for me, that's the thing. In a lot of the charter language that we have here in Pennsylvania, you're not comparing apples and apples. You're comparing apples and elephants.
Particularly in the sense of who do they accept? Because they're very selective in who gets accepted to some of the charter schools and certainly to the private schools.
So let me ask you, since you've got all of those, the testing that's been done, and you've done it for a couple of years now, do you see any marked difference between the public schools and the charter schools and where the money's going? Because here in Pennsylvania, the public schools are still doing, for the most part, better than the charters and way better than the cyber charters, yet we're funding the charters and the cyber charters at a higher rate.
That is correct. We are not seeing any better results out of the charters or the private schools supported by vouchers than what you would see in a public school. Now, are there variations in there? Of course, some are better than others, both in the public school realm and in the charter school realm and in the private school realm. But the bottom five schools in testing in Indiana statewide are almost always charter schools.
Yeah, because I look at this and I ask the question, you know, the schools that are having having trouble, no matter what they are. Are we talking about schools that are in high poverty areas? And isn't that the bigger problem than the schools themselves? And shouldn't that be where we put money into instead of dividing up the pot between all of these different avenues?
You are preaching to the choir here. That's exactly what our group says. If we would invest the same effort and the same money in our public schools that people are trying to put into the privatization of schools, we would have an entirely different landscape here. And frequently when you look at, you know, what schools are labeled as failing, and we argue over how they determine what public schools are failing, it almost tracks one for one with the poverty rate.
Yeah, I mean, there's something wrong with that. And the more I look at what's going on, what we've done here in Pennsylvania, it's been an urban issue. It's been Philadelphia. It's been Pittsburgh. Now they're talking about York, places that have large minority communities, high poverty rates. But I keep saying, look, it's coming to our neck of the woods. It's going to come to rural areas. It's going to come to small towns all across the state. Get ready for it. And we need to be doing the education and the organization. And I look at your group, the Indiana Coalition for Public Education, and I go, you know what? What advice would you give folks in Pennsylvania on how you've operated and how we push back against what's coming? Because if it's in Indiana, I guarantee the ALEC legislation, this is probably what part of it is coming our way. So you're kind of the weather vane here. You're showing
yeah, whether
where
it's we
like from.
It or not. Yeah, actually, you will see in the bills that have been passed on this, across the country, they're almost identical in language. They're coming from one place, and so you will probably see the same bills with the same language introduced in Pennsylvania. In fact, I know some of them are already there. So be looking for that standardized legislation, and then you need to have people who very carefully watch that legislation for you. We have a man who's head of our coalition who is a former school principal and administrator, and he's an amazing man with numbers, and he will take those budgets and analyze them and sometimes even go back to the person who wrote the bill and say, did you intend for this to happen? And they'll go, no, that's not in my bill. And he'll go, yeah, it is. You've got to add it up. So you've got to watch the legislation like a hawk, and then you've got to spread the word, let people know what's going on, and keep up the pressure, because the other side is very well funded, and they're very slick, and they've got very good messages. So unless you're banding together intelligently, the other side will win.
Yeah, I don't know about,
I'm sorry to say, public schools don't always tell their story as well as they should.
Well, they don't have the revenue. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
We don't have any billionaires saying we need to save public schools. We've got a lot of billionaires spending a lot of money on advertising, telling me why these cyber charter schools are the latest, greatest, newfangled thing to come on the market. Best thing since sliced bread. And, oh, hey, let's get it while it lasts.
Well, you have to look at the economics of a cyber charter school, and that they can put a lot of kids in front of computers with not very many teachers and not very many adults. So somebody makes a lot of money.
Absolutely. And then the reason I keep bringing this up is I understand tomorrow you're going to have a rally at the Indiana State House talking about this very issue. And I understand, because here it's a very bipartisan issue. Hey, let's run towards privatizing our schools. In fact, we had a gubernatorial candidate, a prominent Democrat, who got a whole bunch of money from the privatization people to run a losing gubernatorial candidacy just to push the issue. So
right.
in Pennsylvania, it's a bipartisan thing. Hey, let's privatize education. Wonderful idea.
And it does fall pretty much along party lines in Indiana. However, we are a bipartisan coalition, so we have both Republicans and Democrats and independents in our coalition. And we do have some Republicans who are speaking on our behalf tomorrow who have stood up to their peers and said, I know this is, you know, you believe this, but I can't go with you on this.
So that's why
we are very grateful that we have Republicans who have stood with us.
That's why what's the rationale on their part? Because for me, you know, I look at our Republicans, and a lot of them, you know, they're pretty well lockstep. You know, the party says do this, that's where they go, that's the platform. So how did you get folks in Indiana to say, you know, this is not what's in the best interest of our state, of our children, and our future?
Well, I think Vanita Becker, the one of our speakers tomorrow, is from the Evansville area. She was always on the side of public schools. We didn't have to do anything to convince her. Randy Truitt, who is one of our other speakers tomorrow, voted for a lot of the reform legislation, and then all of a sudden he started hearing from people in his district. He started thinking about it and realized we were moving too fast. And so he said, I just think we've made a mistake here by moving too fast, by trying things that haven't really been tried and proven elsewhere. And, you know, this is Indiana. We don't like to move that fast. We like to take our time and figure it out and do it right.
Yeah.
And so he kind of did a 180 after he had voted for some of it, and he got his mind changed on it. But we have others, other Republicans who have voted against the vouchers in the past. And so we're counting on them again. And the other issue that we are talking about tomorrow in our rally is that our schools have had deep budget cuts. And we understand that that had to happen when the economy was bad. But now that the economy is getting better, the schools need that money back.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. $2 billion over the last 2 years they got it from public education,
right,
while at the same time pushing these charters and pushing this division. In fact, one of the school districts down in Philadelphia for 2 months didn't have a dime to pay their teachers, yet they paid the consultant who runs the charter school over $16 million. So you figure that one out, because I can't. I don't know how that's good for the system.
In Indiana, when property taxes are collected, and now our school tuition, so to speak, our general fund is paid by the state and not property taxes, but a portion is paid by property taxes. And when charters first came in, if not everybody pays their property taxes, then schools, you know, don't get a portion of their money because of the non-payment. Except charter schools got 100%.
Yep.
That's not fair.
Well, it's exactly what we've done here. I mean, in fact, charter schools here in Pennsylvania are paid first.
Yes,
they're paid
that's
full,
pretty much how it goes.
First. So before we pay for the public schools, the brick and mortar school, first to the profiteers. And that seems to me to be a horrible thing. But
yes,
again, the push towards where we're going.
Right.
But I give you credit for what you're doing, and we'd love to have someone tell us how the rally went tomorrow in your state capital.
Okay, well, we'd love to come and tell you about it another time.
Thanks so much, Marilyn.
Thanks for having
me. Great talking with you. Marilyn Schenck, board member with the Indiana Coalition for Public Education. Their rally tomorrow in their state house. You know, again, this is the stuff we need to be doing here, folks. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
In conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
In a recent senatorial dust-up, Senator John McCain dubbed his Republican colleague Rand Paul one of the, quote, wacko birds in Congress. McCain, who sometimes appears not too tightly wrapped himself, was giving Senator Paul a tongue-lashing for having mounted a 13-hour old-fashioned standalone filibuster over the possibility that murderous drones could be used for targeted assassinations of Americans right here at home. McCain said that the Kentucky senator's talkathon had veered into, quote, the realm of the ridiculous, adding that, I don't think it is helpful to the American people. I hate to interrupt when one Republican Solon is hammering another, but I'm siding with Rand Paul. While plenty of the Tea Party senators' extreme right-wing stands are wacko, this isn't one of them. Unfortunately for America, powerful corporate interests are eager to reap billions in profit from the spread of drones across our land, and police agencies at all levels are drooling at the prospect of adding weaponized fleets of drones to their arsenals. Indeed, what's ridiculous is that other Congress critters have not been paying attention, speaking out, and taking action. Call it grandstanding if you want, but at least Paul took an actual stand. And, contrary to McCain's opinion, it was quite helpful to the American people. Thanks to Paul's attention-getting combination of principle, ego, and chutzpah, the great majority of Americans heard for the first time that these inherently invasive, liberty-busting, and potentially deadly drones are on the verge of being deployed domestically. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's why the Congressional Progressive Caucus and such alert Democrats as Senator Ron Wyden have joined in sounding the alarm and demanding a full public debate on the cost to our democracy before we let profiteers unleash this technology on us. As Senator Paul says, at least we need to know what are the rules. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you the most? The cuts, the tax
cuts? Well, usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis just like every other state just about has a pension crisis.
You've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced 2 previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
Well, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I go, what else can I sell off? What state assets can I put on the chopping block? What would my corporate masters want from me? I mean, granted, we've given away the drilling. That's down the road, and all the profits from, 71% of the companies in the Commonwealth don't pay a dime of tax because they push it through that little box. What else can we sell off? The lottery, why not? And what the heck? Why not the weird wine and spirit shops, too, because we get a lot of money? Well, or maybe not, which is why I've asked our crack reporter, man on the scene, man on the spot, Jake Long, to come talk to us about the privatization scheme. Jake, what'd you see today?
Well, it was a pretty contentious meeting. I mean, they were polite to each other, but all during the meeting, there were a lot of differences of opinion. Let me set the framework here. The big bill is House Bill 790. Now, according to the Democrats, they only received that last Tuesday. In the meantime, obviously, there weren't the Republicans, although not all the Republicans want privatization. In general, it's the Republicans. There weren't any meetings between last Tuesday and now. They weren't allowed to ask questions. There was an effort to table the vote on 790. That was
twice.
That was voted down along party lines, 14-10. There were quite a few amendments I'm going to get into later. And every one of those amendments, 5 or 6 of them, were voted down along party lines, 14-10. There wasn't one amendment, however, where obviously one Republican crossed over. That was the amendment to allocate more resources under the privatization scheme, since you're at minimum doubling the number of stores from 600 to 1,200, or outlets, I should say, from 600 to 1,200, and in that vote, there was a Republican that came over. There was an amendment proposed, Amendment 375, which added even more contention to the meeting. Would you believe that they only got that email Friday? They got the email Friday, which they may or may not have read in total. Again, they didn't have very much time until the meeting here on Monday. Many of the representatives wanted time not only to go back into their district on House Bill 790, and on top of that, the Republicans added an amendment. And, the complaint that a lot of citizens, when you talk to them about government, is, there's too much secrecy up there. There's too many games played. There's not enough transparency. And here you have one side making it as difficult as possible to air this important bill. Now, they kept making the point that this has been going on. The chairman kept saying, well, this has been going on for 80 years. Well, that's true, but the provisions in these bills need to be aired and have a public vetting. Let me give you an idea of some of the provisions under the amendment. For the first 12 months, beer distributorships will have the option of selling wine, spirits, or both. That option will be given to the public. They have the same choice for any for fees anywhere from $9,500 to $10,500. The number of licensees will depend on population, Rick, in each area. According to this amendment, it will be along the lines of a store for every 15,000 people. They'll be able to sell under these provisions from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. during the week and on Sunday and during the week, 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. All the state stores are going to have to be closed under this bill within the first 6 months. And here's a provision that I found odd. The chairman kept reiterating several times that if during that 6 months the number of stores goes below 100, at that point they are making a definitive decision that it doesn't make a lot of sense to have the stores open at all, and they're just going to close all of them at that point, which I wasn't aware of.
So then what you're saying then is, let's say that it isn't profitable to have a store in, like, say, Carlisle. So there would be none. They would close the state store, and nobody would fill that void.
That's right. Well, and they would close them all down, according to the chairman, which I to me doesn't make sense, but I think it's just another attempt by the privatization forces to speed this up and push it along as fast as it can. Here's an interesting provision, Rick. The law now says that if you sell gasoline, you can't sell alcoholic beverages. There's a prohibition in the present law where they're going to take that away. So under this, can you imagine? They're going to be able to sell gasoline and alcohol.
Yeah, I've been saying that for the longest time, Jake. It's going to go back to when I was a kid. You know, you could go into get your gas, get your liquor, all at once. Like when I was in Cleveland, I went to pay the gas bill. There was a bottle of wine right there next to the Tic Tacs. I could have bought my Tic Tacs and my wine, paid my gas bill right to the road.
Yep. Can you imagine that? I mean, is that toxic or what?
No, it's nothing. I can imagine it. I've lived it, Jake.
Wow. That's amazing. Here's another provision that we these little things that the Pennsylvania public doesn't know anything about. They keep talking about jobs. There was a question by Representative Davis from Bucks County. Well, what happens under this privatization scheme? You go in and you purchase wine or whiskey, and there happens to be a young person in there underage. What does the law say? Well, under the law, under this bill, that young person cannot sell that customer any alcoholic beverages. So that's going to cause a lot of problems. I mean, what do you do if the only person serving you is underage?
Well, you just don't hire them.
You just don't get it. That's right.
Well, you don't hire them.
That's right.
That makes life easy. Solved.
Now, they offered an amendment, Rick, to postpone this whole vote till April 9th. That was voted down again along party lines. That was Representative Boyle who proposed that amendment. He was seconded by Representative Acosta, and that was turned down along party lines. I have to say the star for the Democrats seemed to be Representative Wheatley. He had two or three sessions, and he asked some pointed questions. I can't get into all of them. We don't have time. But I think the one question he asked, which comes to the heart of the problem, he said, look, under this law, do the municipalities have any power to regulate how many will be, let's say, within a small town, how many will be there, what areas of that municipality will they be? In other words, you and I have always just been marveled at Washington, D.C. You go through there in certain areas of the city, literally have a wine and liquor store in each corner. We've seen that repeatedly.
Yep.
Under this provision, the determining factor will be the free market. We always hear the conservatives talk about the markets, and I've heard you talk about it 1,000 times. They act like, you know, everything's going to be all right as long as you allow the free market to work its magic hand. Well, we found out in other states that doesn't work because, unfortunately, too often, there's too many of these stores in poor areas. There's not enough stores in rural areas. It impacts on the poor. The question by Mr. Wheatley was, look, why shouldn't municipalities have some say in that so they can regulate it and minimize the damage? Well, under this law, they don't have any leeway. Let me give you an idea of some of the amendments. Amendment 362 was defeated along party lines. That would increase state police enforcement by one officer for every 15 new licenses. That was voted down, incredibly voted down. According to the state police, if the license is double, the cost could be a minimum of $15 million. That's just if they double. Now, you and I both know, Rick, that over time, you know, there's going to be probably a lot more than 1,200. So you start doing the numbers. That's another cost that we don't even talk about that's going to be incurred by the taxpayers. Amendment 371. Here's an interesting one. It would have prohibited political contributions by those who have a wine and spirit license. Now, why wouldn't you do that for wine and spirit licensees? We did that. We prohibited them from being involved in the political process for those who were involved in gambling. Why wouldn't we do the same thing here? Well, guess what? Surprise, surprise. It was voted down 14-10. House Bill 790. This one passed. Well, the big bill finally did pass by 14-10. Temporary wine and spirits, they will be able to, organizations like fire companies will be allowed to purchase them for about $30 a day at up to 4 days. That passed. House Bill 623, amendment passed 14-10. That would prohibit fire companies from transferring licenses to other organizations.
So there's
at the
a
end
lot,
of the
there's
day,
a lot
Ray,
to all of this.
What's that?
There's a lot to it then. I mean, wrap it up.
Yes. And actually, what the Democrats offered were, well, look, they said two things. They said they tried to minimize the damage, and they tried to say to the opposition, look, we need to be fair to the taxpayers. We need to vent this bill, take it out to the public, at least allow them to go to public meetings and vent their opinions. They were turned down. It goes to now the full House. You still have time to contact your state rep. Certainly you have time to contact your state senator. This battle, we lost this battle, but the war certainly isn't lost. There's a lot of questions out there that need to be answered, and you need to contact your state rep, especially right now.
Yep.
There's going to be a lot of pressure on those people from the Republican Party
yep.
to vote yes.
And you know, get Corbett and Turzai right now are twisting arms and calling in favors.
Absolutely, because they know, Rick, next year, let's be honest, next year is an election year that becomes increasingly difficult for some of those at-risk Republicans, especially down around Philadelphia.
Yep. Well, this is why we got to call them early, call them often.
Absolutely.
Jake, I appreciate the update. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
America for the better.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
You gotta love our hurry up and get out there. Get out the news, media culture. Gotta get it out. Get it out as fast as possible. You know, I look at the fake news on Fox, and I think CNN and MSNBC did the same thing. This whole Steubenville rape case. While they put out the two guys' names, it's generally been that they don't put out the victim's name. They don't do that. Especially if it's a minor, it's like a double don't do. Well, I guess all three, CNN, MSNBC, and fake news on Fox, they allowed the girl's name to go out over the national airwaves. And what I've found very interesting is since the verdict, a lot of really just feeling sorry for the two guys who did this. They did this to themselves. I listened to CNN say, oh, how promising these kids' careers were going to be. They were good students. And you got ABC making excuses. And, you know, they had promising football careers, all this wonderful stuff. Oh, it was just, you know, they were just drunk. It was a mistake. Oh, what's going to happen to these poor kids? How about we send the message, you don't rape people? Probably not a bad message to send. Maybe had they gotten that message, maybe they wouldn't be in this mess. Just a thought. Anyway, Washington, D.C., and talk to our correspondent there, Victoria Jones. Talk. You've been following the updates. I mean, when I turn on the news, all I hear is, oh, these two guys. And I'm going, well, maybe they shouldn't have, you know. Now, look, I get, you know, hey, I will tell my daughters, don't get drunk and don't do stupid things. But I got to tell my son, don't rape. It's pretty simple, I think.
I think it's fairly straightforward, and I think you tell the news organizations, don't release the names of underage girls who've been raped over the air.
And look, fake news on Fox has this editing problem a lot. They do a lot of things that you could say questionable, and oh, it was an editing mistake. Oops, didn't mean it, but it got out. Is it it's a rush to get the stuff out?
Yes.
Is it incompetence?
Yes.
Or is it deliberate?
No. I think it's a rush, and I think it's incompetent. I don't think it was deliberate. I don't believe that there are, because these are young, stupid, I don't know if they're stupid, that's judgmental on my part. These are young, keen, 20-something, if they're 20-something people trying to make these decisions, probably decisions some of them are not even ready to make, about what goes on the air. And I think in the case of the girl, when they put out this raw footage of the apology, they just put it out, and they didn't preview it to bleep it.
Yeah.
They don't preview.
All right, gotta get it out. It's a hurry. Gotta do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just, you know, it's amazing to me. And I, you know, you think you just, well, I look at this whole case, and for me, this case would be very simple. That wouldn't have been a trial about two teenagers who raped a girl. It would have been a trial of a parent who killed two teenagers.
Oh.
Well, you know, it just is what it is. But that's, again, goes back to me. So what's going on in the news?
Well, a number of things are going on in the news. It's quite a newsy kind of day. The Republican National Committee released its autopsy report today and concluded, after a sweeping self-analysis of the party's 2012 election losses, that it wasn't pretty. Focus groups described the Republicans as narrow-minded, out of touch, and, quote, stuffy old men.
Okay. But hold on, it's an autopsy report. Now let me get this straight, because I keep hearing from the Republicans that the American people want that because they held the House, not because they gerrymandered it, but because that's what the American people wanted.
Well, what they feel is that, I know what you're saying is unarguable, but I think they feel if they'd been less like stuffy old men, they could have had it all.
Uh-huh. I don't agree.
That's what they feel.
So
Reince Priebus doesn't agree with you.
Well, I don't think a lot of people agreed with him, to be honest, because I know some folks who think, wow, and I look at Paul Ryan, who's running the same budget plan that he ran on as a VP candidate. I see a lot of the same policy. Is there any policy change coming out of this quote unquote autopsy?
Not really. I mean, they do say that they want to embrace comprehensive immigration overhaul, which a cynic might say would be to get the Hispanic vote. But I'm not a cynic, so I won't say that. Although it was interesting, in one of the reports that I read today, Priebus was there, and there was another senior RNC person there as well at this event at the press club when they were announcing this. And it was assumed that that meant comprehensive immigration overhaul means a path to citizenship. And she said that doesn't necessarily mean a path to citizenship. But he didn't say that. So that gives to me the idea that, well, they haven't decided, which is kind of like the way the Republicans are in Congress. They haven't decided whether they do support or don't support a path to citizenship. But other than that, there were no other policy changes, because they don't think the policies are wrong.
Right.
They think it's the communication, not the principles.
Yeah, they just haven't sold it right yet. They think they got the right product. They just haven't beaten us over the head with it enough.
And they intend to make it very, very sexy and appealing to young people. They intend to really rebrand and really go for it.
Yeah. Well, what's wrong with that?
That's what they're going to do. I'm not saying there's anything. I'm saying that's what they're going to do.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear it. I can't wait to see the rollout with a new logo, maybe.
It's going to be bigger than that. It's going to be bigger than big.
Okay, so is it this, or is it just, you know, because one of the things that I read is they want to back out of the number of primary debates.
Oh, that's another piece. The other piece is they want to drop that down to maybe 10 debates. They want to speed up the primary process. They don't want to have their convention in August. They want to have their convention as early as June. They want their nominee. They want their nominee freed up to start spending money.
And that would have been good for Romney early on. Not so good for anybody else who didn't have a boatload of cash, I would think.
Exactly. But they want to, I think, as cynics might say, they want to control who the nominee is, so that it's the nominee that the RNC likes with a boatload of cash and not a fringe candidate. And there has been huge pushback from the right of the party about this report.
Yeah, I can't wait, because I would assume the fringe would be Rand Paul.
Well, the fringe is actually almost anybody who disagrees with this report, and that's a large part of the party.
Wow.
A large part of the party who feels that this is a Washington report.
Wow, I can't wait to see more of the fallout and more of the inner party bickering, because I like watching them tear each other apart.
I understand that.
Yeah, I think it's good for business.
I understand that.
Speaking about tearing things apart, it looks like David Vitter is going to be the guy holding up the Perez nomination. What do we know about Thomas Perez?
Thomas Perez is Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. He was nominated by President Obama today to be his next Labor Secretary, somebody who Obama said is a man who reminds us of this country's promise. That if you're willing to work hard, it doesn't matter who you are or where you came from, what your last name is, you can make it if you try. David Vitter is promising to hold him up over a couple of issues. One is a Louisiana issue, something to do with Louisiana. I don't know the details. I haven't seen the news story about the details yet. But the other one is a red meat issue for
The Black Panthers, the
Black
new
Panthers.
Black Panthers, not the old Black Panthers.
No, the new Black
new
Panthers,
ones.
The new ones. It's over a newly released report. This is what's significant about this report is it's the Justice Department's own internal watchdog, the Inspector General. This report has significance and has credibility. That found that he gave incomplete testimony on the decision to drop charges against members of the New Black Panthers. There does seem to be something to this, that he was, shall we say, less forthcoming than he could have been in his testimony. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Yeah, well, we'll see where it goes. I always like to see the destruction of good people, because then we end up with, well, with Republicans in office.
Well, I'm not sure that'll happen. Not sure it'll go that far. I just think he's going to get some tough questions.
Okay. Well, we will see. Part of me goes, either way. So the Supreme Court, some new arguments today?
Yeah, interesting case today. The case today is on Arizona's voting registration law.
And how does that work?
Well, remember motor voter law?
Yep.
Right. The idea was that came into force, that the federal law, make it the same everywhere, one simple form, make it easier for people to register to vote.
Yep.
Arizona.
See, I have a different idea, Victoria.
Go on.
I have an idea that I think would be even better than motor voter.
Go on.
I think we should do what a lot of the Republicans say that we should do with like a 401k type plan. Which is that everyone is enrolled until you opt out. As a citizen of the country, as someone with a Social Security card, kind of like when you're 18 and selective service and all of that stuff, once you're 18, once you're eligible to vote, you are signed, you go, you sign up just like that, and then you are registered to vote until you opt out.
I agree with you. I'm with you.
This idiocy that we need to go out and do all these voter registration drives and all is ludicrous. All of the paperwork, all of the stuff that, all of the games, oh, we're going to throw away people with 80-pound, their registrations aren't on 80-pound paper, and, oh, if you didn't vote last time, we're going to purge the rolls. Ridiculous. Long as you're alive, as long as you're a citizen, as long as you got a Social Security card, you're in. Just my
view. I don't disagree with you at all.
Okay, so what is this? I'm sure our Supreme Court would disagree, but what are the arguments today?
Well, the argument today is, does federal law trump state law on this issue, or Arizona, which added some things through a ballot initiative, which made it more complicated and meant that you actually had to provide all kinds of different bits of ID to the motor voter law when you went to register to vote. Is that okay? Is it just enhancing the federal law? Or is, in fact, that making it more cumbersome? Those were the arguments today. So the question was, which way are the justices going to come down on this one? Because, you know, we don't know where they might fall. Well, interestingly, and of course, Kennedy, so far on voter ID has gone with the conservatives. He asked some interesting questions, raised concerns about the law. He basically said that the whole utility of having one registration form is lost if it's made too complicated by states requiring additional information, which was an interesting point.
Interesting.
And Justice Scalia repeatedly told the Arizona Attorney General that the state should have filed a lawsuit saying that the Election Assistance Commission's decision on something was unlawful, particularly in light of another case in which Louisiana was granted permission to require additional materials. That you should have challenged the commission's refusal to place that evidence in the federal form. He kept going on about this. In other words, what Scalia was saying was, you brought the wrong case.
Huh.
Or you may have brought the wrong case.
And then that would mean going back to the very beginning and this being the way it is until that comes through the system again.
Well, yes. In other words, that this might not be the case that wins.
Interesting.
So, but we won't know until June. And there's a very interesting case tomorrow, which you start your reporter about, which is about allowing lawsuits over generic drugs. And it's the key case. It's the absolute key case whether courts should be able to second guess approval decisions by the FDA or not.
Well, going back to the Scalia statement not too long ago, we shouldn't leave the job of deciding what drugs are good and bad up to the government. or up to, you know, the Congress or the FDA. We shouldn't leave that up to them. It should be up to, it should be up to the Supreme Court. It should be up to Scalia. Let's, we're going to make Scalia king.
There you go.
Yeah. And finally, what's going on in the little island of Cyprus?
Well, the little island of Cyprus is melting away and in a bit of a mess over a bailout, and in which they had the brilliant idea that, well, let's levy everybody a tax, one-time tax, on the amount that they've got in the bank, 6.75% if you've got less than 100,000 euros and 9.9% if you've got more than that. Well, not surprisingly, that sent everybody on the island of Cyprus ballistic, and they all started running off to the ATMs over the weekend.
Nice. Did no one think that through? Did no one think?
No.
No one thought. No one said, "Hey, you know, I can see doing it Saturday night and saying, okay, first thing Sunday morning, take a look and bang, it's taxed." Because then there's no run. It's just, you know, we got ripped off. Especially, you know, the poor folks who had like $50 in the bank and they couldn't. They really can't afford it.
Nobody thought it through. So, of course, they closed all the banks until Thursday now. And the newly elected president, who's only been in office for 3 weeks, is now trying to sell the whole idea to his parliament, and he doesn't hold a majority. And at least three of the other parties have already said, well, we're not voting for it. And they've got a big, big shindig tomorrow, big debate tomorrow, and a vote tomorrow to try and see if they can get it amended. They've been given permission to amend it. They've been told, yeah, you can amend it. Do what you like. As long as you repay the bailout money, we don't care how you do it, but you've got to repay the bailout money. So they're going to probably adjust the levy. But the people of Cyprus are furious, saying, we didn't do this. What about the politicians? What about the banks?
What about the banks? I mean, I look at this, and you want to kill banks? Make this the precedence that we use all bailouts on. You want to see nobody ever putting money in banks again? And maybe that's not, wait a minute, maybe that's not a bad idea.
There you go.
Maybe this is how we break up too big to fail.
Ooh.
Gonna have to think that one through. But as always, Victoria, great talking with you. I appreciate the update.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
On March 13, 2013, the ALMA telescope in the Atacama Desert in northern Chile officially came online. ALMA stands for Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. This telescope will be able to see the universe in a resolution 10 times greater than that of the Hubble Space Telescope. Allison Peck, ALMA Deputy Project Scientist, explained that the altitude, 16,500 feet or 5,000 meters, and the dry desert climate of ALMA's location helped make it so powerful.
The main enemy of millimeter or submillimeter astronomy is not light, like it is for optical telescopes, but rather water. Having a location like this, high in the mountains, up in the desert, means that your sensitivity is much, much greater than it would be anywhere else in the world.
Though not the first telescope of its kind, it's the fastest and most powerful. ALMA will penetrate clouds of dust and gas to help astronomers study the birth of planets, stars, and galaxies in the near and distant universe.
Things that have never been detectable before, things that appear dark to optical telescopes, will be detectable with ALMA.
The ALMA array, consisting of six large radio dishes connected together, will allow astronomers to look 12 billion years back in time. For more on the ALMA telescope, come to EarthSky.org and search ALMA. That's A-L-M-A. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Every now and then I visit an elementary school. Talking with children is a pretty good idea, I think. They ask questions we don't think about, and they ask them very directly. Recently, a little girl wanted to know, what's the hardest part of your job? That got me thinking. I looked down and I told her, the hardest part is telling people no.
Well, yeah, I guess, yeah, the hardest part is saying, I'm sorry, little girl, no education for you. I'm sorry, I'm sorry that we're going to have to slash funding for education, and I'll give a whole bunch of money to charter schools, but this way we could have money leaving the state through philanthropic, benevolent billionaires' profit. I'm sorry, no. No infrastructure, no education, no healthcare, sorry. No. He's done pretty well at telling little girls no. He's done fairly well at telling working people no. Not so well at the no to the drilling people, the big corporate special interests. Not so good at that. But very, very, very good at saying no to the rest of us. Which is why you look at his approval ratings. Not good. His disapproval ratings for me, really good. I mean, through the roof. And you got to wonder, what are his chances next year? And with this privatization scheme, is it that they're reading the tea leaves and saying, well, people want to have convenience and they really care? I don't think so. I think what we should have been doing is spending a lot of time figuring out how to create jobs and get people back to work. That would have made him a memorable governor, somebody that I would have considered voting for. Because to be honest, you know, when he was up for election, the guy that ran against him wasn't really all that better of a choice. It was bad and less bad. And early on, I wasn't sure who the bad or less bad was until Corbett took the rightward Tea Party lean. And as soon as he followed down that radical path, that's when I said, well, you know, maybe not. Interesting stuff. Anyway, interesting comment today. It was the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. I guess it was actually sometime early last week when she said this. Senator Elizabeth Warren was talking to a professor from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she said, you know, if we start in 1960 and we said that as productivity goes up, that is, the workers produce more, then the minimum wage goes up at the same rate. And if that were the case, the minimum wage, she said, would be about $22 an hour. And she said, hey, where did the money go? If, you know, it's supposed to be $22 an hour, it's 7 1/4, where'd the $14.75 go? Where'd the rest of that money go? And according to the professor, in his estimation, that's true, and had it kept up with the top 1% of income folks, the very, very wealthy in the country, the minimum wage would be closer to $33 an hour. So now the radical right taking to this, well, let's make it $100 an hour. That's not what they're saying. In fact, Warren doesn't want it to be $22 or $33 an hour. So it should be just over $10 and then indexed for inflation so that as productivity goes up and as, you know, we have growth, everyone shares in this. And for me, I look at it, if it were $22 an hour, do you think we'd have a more robust consumer economy? Well, one could make that argument. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, the Rick Smith Show .com, where you can go get the podcast. Also, you can get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Questions, comments, something I said got under your skin, on your nerves, or made you think, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We will be moving. Thursday and Friday will be reruns so that we can move into our new studio, so we'll let you know on that. But we're looking forward to the move. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rage.